tipping back her head to grant him access to her neck. Rowan obliged her silent demand, pressing kisses and soft, growling nips to her throat.
I've never taken a woman on a beach,
he purred against her skin, sucking gently on the space between her neck and shoulder.
And look at that. We're far from any sort of collateral.
One hand drifted from her hip to caress the scars on her back, the other sliding to cup her backside, drawing her fully against him. Aelin spread her hands over his chest, tugging his white shirt over his head. Warm waves crashed against them, but Rowan held her fast, unmovable, unshakable. Aelin remembered herself enough to say,
Someone might come looking for us.
Rowan huffed a laugh against her neck.
Something tells me,
he said, his breath skittering along her skin.
You might not mind if we were discovered. If someone saw how thoroughly I plan to worship you.
She felt the words dangling there, felt herself dangling there, off the edge of the cliff. She swallowed. But Rowan had caught her each time she had fallen. First, when she had plummeted into that abyss of despair and grief. Second, when that castle had shattered and she had plunged to the earth. And now this time, this third time, she was not afraid. Aelin met Rowan's stare and said clearly and baldly and without a speckle of doubt,
I love you. I am in love with you, Rowan. I have been for a while. And I know there are limits to what you can give me, and I know you might need time.
His lips crushed into hers, and he set onto her mouth, dropping words more precious than rubies and emeralds and sapphires into her heart, her soul.
I love you. There is no limit to what I can give to you, no time I need. Even when this world is a forgotten whisper of dust between the stars, I will love you.
Aelin didn't know when she started crying, when her body began shaking with the force of it. She had never said such words, to anyone, never let herself be that vulnerable, never felt this burning and unending thing, so consuming she might die from the force of it. Rowan pulled back, wiping away her tears with his thumbs, one after another. He said softly, barely audible over the crashing waves around them,
Fireheart.
She sniffed back tears.
Buzzard.
He roared a laugh, and she let him lay her down on the sand with a gentleness near reverence. His sculpted chest heaved slightly as he ran an eye over her bare body.
You are so beautiful.
She knew he didn't just mean the skin and curves and bones. But Aelin still smiled, humming.
I know,
she said, lifting her arms above her head, setting the amulet of Orinth onto a safe high part of the beach. Her fingers dug into the soft sand as she arched her back in a slow stretch. Rowan tracked every movement, every flicker of muscle and skin. When his gaze lingered on her breasts, gleaming with seawater, his expression turned ravenous. Then his gaze slid lower, lower. And when it lingered on the apex of her thighs and his eyes glazed, Aelin said to him,
Are you gonna stand there gawking all night?
Rowan's mouth parted slightly, his breathing shallow, his body already showing her precisely where this was going to end. A phantom wind hissed through the palms, whispered over the sand. Her magic tingled as she felt, more than saw, Rowan's shield fall into place around them. She sent her own power tracing over it, knocking and tapping at the shield in sparks of flame. Rowan's canines gleamed.
Nothing is getting past that shield, and nothing is going to hurt me, either.
Something tight in her chest eased.
Is it that different? With someone like me?
I don't know,
Rowan admitted. Again, his eyes slid along her body, as if he could see through skin to her burning heart beneath.
I've never been with an equal. I've never allowed myself to be that unleashed.
For every bit of power she threw at him, he'd throw back at her. She braced herself on her elbows, lifting her mouth to the new scar on his shoulder, the wound small and jagged, as broad as an arrowhead. She kissed it once, twice. Rowan's body was so tense above hers she thought his muscles would snap. But his eyes were gentle as they drifted to her back, stroking her scars and the tattoos he'd inked over them. The waves tickled and caressed her, and he made to settle over her, but she lifted a hand to his chest, halting him dead. She smiled against his mouth.
If we're equals, then I don't understand why you're still half-clothed.
She didn't give him the chance to explain as she traced her tongue over the seam of his lips, as her fingers unlatched the buckle of his worn sword belt. She wasn't sure he was breathing. And just to see what he'd do, she palmed him through his pants. Rowan barked a curse. She laughed quietly, kissed his newest scar again, and dragged a finger down lazily, indolently, holding his gaze for every single inch she touched. And when Aelin laid her palm flat on him again, she said,
"You are mine."
Rowan's breathing started again, jagged and savage as the waves breaking around them. She flicked open the top button of his pants.
"I'm yours,"
he ground out. Another button popped free.
"And you love me,"
she said. Not a question.
"To whatever end,"
he breathed. She popped the third and final button free, and he let go of her to toss his pants into the sand nearby, taking his undershorts with them. Her mouth went dry as she took in the sight of him. Rowan had been bred and honed for battle, and every inch of him was pure-blooded warrior. He was the most beautiful thing she'd ever seen. Hers. He was hers, and
"You are mine,"
Rowan breathed, and she felt the claiming in her bones, her soul.
"I am yours,"
she answered.
"And you love me."
Such hope and quiet joy in his eyes, beneath all that fierceness.
"To whatever end."
For too long had he been alone and wandering. No longer. Rowan kissed her again. Slow, soft. A hand slid up the plane of her torso while he lowered himself over her, his hips nestling against hers. She gasped a bit at the touch, gasped a bit more as his knuckle grazed the heavy, aching underside of her breast, as he leaned down to kiss the other. His teeth grazed over her nipple, and her eyes drifted closed, a moan slipping out of her.
Oh, gods. Oh, burning, rutting gods.
Rowan knew what he was doing. He really godsdamned did. His tongue flicked against her nipple, and her head tipped back, her fingers digging into his shoulders, urging him to take more, take harder. Rowan growled his approval, her breast still in his mouth, on his tongue, his hand making lazy strokes from her ribs down her waist, down her thighs, then back up. She arched in silent demand. A phantom touch, like the northern wind given form, flicked over her bare breast. Aelin burst into flames. Rowan laughed darkly at the reds and golds and blues that erupted around them, illuminating the palms that towered over the edge of the beach, the waves breaking behind him. She might have panicked, might have been mortified, had he not lifted his mouth to hers, had those phantom hands of ice-kissed wind not kept working her breasts, had his own hand not continued stroking, closer and closer to where she needed him.
"You're magnificent,"
he murmured onto her lips, his tongue sliding into her mouth. The hardness of him pushed against her, and she bucked her hips, needing to grind herself against him, to do anything to ease the building ache between her legs. Rowan groaned, and she wondered if there was any other male in the world who would be so naked and prone with a woman on fire, who would not look at those flames with any ounce of fear. She slid her hand between them, and when she closed her fingers around him, marveling at the velvet-wrapped steel, Rowan groaned again, pushing into her hand. She pulled her mouth from his, staring into those pine-green eyes as she slid her hand along him. He lowered his head, not to kiss her, but to watch where she stroked him. A roaring wind full of ice and snow blasted around them, and it was her turn to huff a laugh. But Rowan gripped her wrist, drawing her hand away. She opened her mouth in protest, wanting to touch more, taste more.
"Let me,"
Rowan growled onto the sea-slick skin between her breasts.
"Let me touch you."
His voice trembled enough that Aelin lifted his chin with her thumb and forefinger. A flicker of fear and relief shone beneath the glazed lust, as if doing this, touching her, was as much to remind him that she had made it today, that she was safe, as it was to pleasure her. She leaned up, brushing her mouth against his.
"Do your worst, Prince."
Rowan's smile was nothing short of wicked, as he pulled away to run a broad hand from her throat down to the juncture of her thighs. She shuddered at the sheer possession in the touch, her breath coming in tight pants, as he gripped either thigh and spread her legs, bearing her fully for him. Another wave crashed, parting around them, the cool water like a thousand kisses along her skin. Rowan kissed her navel, then her hip. Aelin couldn't take her eyes from his silver hair shining with salt water and moonlight, from the hands holding her wide for him as his head dipped between her legs. And as Rowan tasted her on that beach, as he laughed against her slick skin, while her hoarse cries of his name shattered across palm trees and sand and water, Aelin let go of all pretense at reason. She moved, hips undulating, begging him to go, go, go. So Rowan did, sliding a finger into her as his tongue flicked that one spot, and oh gods, she was going to explode into starfire.
"Aelin,"
he growled, her name a plea.
"Please,"
she moaned,
"please."
The word was his undoing. Rowan rose over her again, and she let out a sound that might have been a whimper, might have been his name. Then Rowan had a hand braced in the sand beside her head, fingers twining in her hair, while the other guided himself into her. At the first nudge of him, she forgot her own name. And as he slid in with gentle rolling thrusts, filling her inch by inch, she forgot that she was queen, and that she had a separate body and a kingdom and a world to look after. When Rowan was seated deep in her, trembling with restraint as he let her adjust, she lifted her burning hands to his face, wind and ice tumbling and roaring around them, dancing across the waves with ribbons of flame. There were no words in his eyes, none in hers either. Words did not do it justice, not in any language, in any world. He leaned in, claiming her mouth as he began to move, and they let go entirely. She might have been crying, or it might have been his tears on her face, turning to steam amid her flames. She dragged her hands down his powerful, muscled back, over scars from battles and terrors long since past. And as his thrusts turned deeper, She dug in her fingers, dragging her nails across his back, claiming him, marking him. His hips slammed home at the blood she drew, and she arched, baring her throat to him. For him. Only him. Rowan's magic went wild, though his mouth on her neck was so careful, even as his canines dragged along her skin. And at the touch of those lethal teeth against her, the death that hovered nearby, and the hands that would always be gentle with her, always love her. Release blasted through her like wildfire, and though she could not remember her name, she remembered Rowan's, as she cried it while he kept moving, wringing every last ounce of pleasure from her, fire searing the sand around them to glass. Rowan's own release barreled through him at the sight of it, and he groaned her name so that she remembered it at last, lightning joining wind and ice over the water. Aelin held him through it, sending the fire opal of her magic to twine with his power. On and on, as he spilled himself in her, lightning and flame danced on the sea. The lightning continued to strike, silent and lovely, even after he stilled. The sounds of the world came pouring back in, his breathing as ragged as the hiss of the crashing waves, while he brushed lazy kisses to her temple, her nose, her mouth. Aelin drew her eyes away from the beauty of their magic, the beauty of them, and found his face to be the most beautiful of all. She was trembling, and so was Rowan as he remained in her. He buried his face in the crook of her neck and shoulder, his uneven breath warming her skin.
I never.
He tried, voice hoarse.
I didn't know it could be.
She ran her fingers down his scarred back, over and over.
I know,
she breathed.
I know.
Already she wanted more. Already she was calculating how long she'd have to wait.
You once told me that you don't bite the females of other males.
Rowan stiffened a bit, but she went on coyly.
Does that mean you'll bite your own female then?
Understanding flashed in those green eyes as he raised his head from her neck to study the spot where those canines had once pierced her skin.
That was the first time I really lost control around you, you know. I wanted to chuck you off a cliff, yet I bit you before I knew what I was doing. I think my body knew. My magic knew. And you tasted.
Rowan loosed a jagged breath.
So good. I hated you for it. I couldn't stop thinking about it. I'd wake up at night with that taste on my tongue. Wake up thinking about your foul, beautiful mouth.
He traced his thumb over her lips.
You don't want to know the depraved things I've thought about this mouth.
Likewise. But you didn't answer my question,
Aelin said, even as her toes curled in the wet sand and warm water.
Yes,
Rowan said thickly.
Some males enjoy doing it. To mark territory. For pleasure.
Do females bite males?
He began to harden again inside her as the question lingered.
Oh, gods, fey lovers. Everyone should be so damn lucky to have one.
Rowan rasped.
Do you want to bite me?
Aelin eyed his throat, his glorious body, and the face she had once so fiercely hated. And she wondered if it were possible to love someone enough to die from it. If it were possible to love someone enough, that time and distance and death were of no concern.
Am I limited to your neck?
Rowan's eyes flared, and his answering thrust was answer enough. They moved together, undulating like the sea before them, and when Rowan roared her name again into the star-flecked black. Aelin hoped the gods themselves heard it, and knew their days were now numbered. Chapter 39. Rowan didn't know whether to be amused, thrilled, or slightly terrified that he'd been blessed with a queen and lover who had so little care for public decency. He'd taken her 3 times on that beach, twice in the sand, then a third out in the warm waters. And yet his very blood was still electrified. And yet he still wanted more. They'd swum into the shallows to wash off the sand crusted on them, but Aelin had wrapped her legs around his waist, kissed his neck, then licked his ear the way he'd nibbled hers, and he was buried in her again. She knew why he needed the contact, why he'd needed to taste her on his tongue, and then with the rest of his body. She'd needed the same. He still needed it. When they'd finished after that first time, he'd been left reeling, to pull his sanity back together after the joining that had unleashed him, broken and remade him. His magic had been a song, and she had been... He'd never had anything like her. Everything he'd given her, she'd given right back to him. And when she had bit him during that second coupling in the sand, his magic had left 6 nearby palm trees in splinters, as he'd climaxed hard enough that he thought his body would shatter. But once they were finished, when she'd actually made to walk back to Skull's Bay in nothing but her flames, he'd given her his shirt and belt, which did little to cover her up, especially those beautiful legs. But at least it was less likely to start a riot. Barely, though. And it'd be obvious what they'd done on that beach the moment they stepped within scenting range of anyone with a preternatural sense of smell. He'd marked her, richer than the scent that had clung to her before. Marked her deep and true, and there was no undoing it, no washing it away. She'd claimed him, and he'd claimed her, and he knew she was well aware of what that claiming meant, just as he knew. He knew it had been a choice on her part. A final decision regarding the matter of who would be in her royal bed. He would try to live up to that honor, try to find some way to prove he deserved it, that she hadn't bet on the wrong horse. Somehow, he'd earn it, even with so little to offer beyond his own magic and heart. But he also knew his queen. And knew that despite the enormity of what they'd done, Aelin had also kept him on that beach to avoid the others, avoid answering their questions and demands. But he made it 1 foot inside the Ocean Rose, saw the light in Adian's room, and knew their friends would not be so easily deterred. Indeed, Aelin was scowling up at the light, though worry quickly replaced it, as she remembered the shifter who had been so thoroughly unconscious. Her bare feet were silent on the stairs and hallway as she hurried for the room, not bothering to knock before flinging open the door. Rowan loosed a sharp breath, trying to draw up his magic to cool the fire still in his blood, to calm the instincts roaring and raging at him. Not to take her, but to eliminate any other threat. A dangerous time for any fey male, when they first took a lover. Worse when it meant something more. Dorian and Adian sat in the 2 armchairs before the darkened fireplace, arms crossed, and her cousin's face went pale with what might have been terror as he scented Aelin, the markings both seen and invisible on them. Lysandra sat in bed, face drawn but eyes narrowed at the queen. It was the shifter who purred, "Enjoy your ride." Adian didn't dare move, and was giving Dorian a warning look to do the same. Rowan bit down against the rage at the sight of other males near his queen, reminding himself that they were his friends. But that primal rage stumbled as he felt Aelin's shuddering relief upon finding the shifter mostly healed and lucid. But his queen only shrugged. Isn't that all these fey males are good for? Rowan raised his brows, chuckling as he debated reminding her how she'd begged him throughout, how she'd said words like please and oh gods, and then a few extra pleases thrown in for good measure. He'd enjoy wringing those rarely seen manners from her again. Aelin shot him a glare, daring him to say it. And despite just having her, despite the fact that he could still taste her, Rowan knew that whenever they found their bed again, she would not get the rest she wanted. Color stained Aelin's cheeks, as if she saw his plans unfold. But she lifted the amulet from around her neck, dropped it onto the low-lying table between Adian and Dorian, and said, I learned that this was the third word key when I was still in Wendlin. Silence. Then, as if she hadn't shattered any sense of safety they still possessed, Aelin withdrew the mangled eye of Elena from her pack, chucked it once in the air, and jerked her chin at the King of Otterlin. I think it's time you met your ancestor. Dorian listened to Aelin's story, about the word key she'd secretly carried, about what had happened today in the bay, about how she'd tricked Lorkin and how it would eventually lead the warrior back to them, hopefully with the other two keys in his hands. And if they were lucky, they would have already found this lock she had been ordered twice now to retrieve from the stone marshes, the only thing capable of binding the word keys back into the gate from which they'd been hewn, and ending the threat of Erewhon forever. No number of allies would make a difference if they could not stop Erewhon from using those keys to unleash the Volg hordes from his own realm upon Irelia. His possession of two keys had already led to such darkness. If he gained the third, gained mastery over the word gate, and could open it to any world at will, use it to summon any conquering army. They had to find that lock to nullify those keys. When the queen was done, Adian was silently fuming, Lysandra was frowning, and Aelin was now snuffing out the candles in the room with hardly a wave of her hand. Two ancient tomes, withdrawn from Adian's crammed saddlebags, lay open on the table. He knew those books. He had no idea she'd taken them from Rifthold. The warped metal of the Eye of Elena amulet sat atop one of them, as Aelin double-checked the markings on an age-spotted page. Darkness fell, as she used her own blood to etch those markings on the wooden floor.
Looks like our bill of damages to this city is going to rise, Lysandra muttered.
Aelin snorted. We'll just move the rug to cover it. She finished making a mark. A word mark, Dorian realized with a chill, and stepped back, plucking up the eye in her fist. Now what? Adian said.
Now we keep our mouths shut, Aelin said sweetly.
The moonlight spread on the floor, devoured by the dark lines she'd etched. Aelin drifted over to where Rowan sat on the edge of the bed, still shirtless thanks to the queen currently wearing his shirt, and took up a spot beside him, a hand on his knee. Lysandra was the first to notice. She sat up in the bed, green eyes glowing with animal brightness, as the moonlight on the blood mark seemed to shimmer. Aelin and Rowan jerked to their feet. Dorian just stared at the marks, at the moonlight, at the beam of it shining through the open balcony doors. As if the light itself were a doorway, the shaft of moonlight turned into a humanoid figure. It flickered, its form barely there, like a figment of a dream. The hair on Dorian's arms rose, and he had the good sense to slide out of his chair and onto a knee as he bowed his head. He was the only one who did so. The only one, he realized, who had spoken to Elena's mate, Gavin. Long ago. Another lifetime ago. He tried not to consider what it meant that he now carried Gavin's sword, Damaris. Aelin had not asked for it back, did not seem inclined to do so. A muffled female voice, as if it were calling from far away, flickered in and out with the image.
Too far,
a light young voice said. Aelin stepped forward and shut those ancient spellbooks before stacking them with a thump. Well, Rifthold isn't exactly available, and your tomb is trashed, so tough luck. Dorian's head lifted as he glanced between the flickering figure of moonlight and the young queen of flesh and blood. Elena's roughly formed body vanished, then reappeared, as if the wind itself disturbed her.
Can't hold.
Then I'll make it quick. Aelin's voice was sharp as a blade. No more games. No more half-truths. Why did Deanna arrive today? I get it, finding the lock is important. But what is it? And tell me what she meant by calling me the queen who was promised. As if the words jolted the dead queen like lightning, his ancestor appeared, fully corporeal. She was exquisite. Her face young and grave, her hair long and silvery white, like Manon's, and her eyes, startling, dazzling blue. They now fixed on him, the pale gown she wore fluttering on a phantom breeze.
Rise, young king.
Aelin snorted. Can we not play the holier-than-thou ancient spirit game? But Elena surveyed Rowan, Adian, her slender, fair neck bobbed. And Aelin, gods above, snapped her fingers at the queen. Once, twice, drawing her attention back to her. Hello, Elena, she drawled. So nice to see you. It's been a while. Care to answer some questions? Irritation flickered in the dead queen's eyes. But Elena's chin remained high, her slender shoulders back.
I do not have much time. The connection is too hard to maintain so far from Rifthold.
What a surprise. The two queens stared each other down. Elena, word damn him, broke first.
Deanna is a god. She does not have rules and morals and codes the way we do. Time does not exist for her the way it does for us. You let your magic touch the key. The key opened a door, and Deanna happened to be watching at that exact moment. That she spoke to you at all is a gift. That you managed to shove her out before she was ready. She will not soon forget that insult, Majesty.
She can get in line, Aelin said. Elena shook her head.
There is so much I did not get to tell you.
Like the fact that you and Gavin never killed Erewhon, lied to everyone about it, and then left him for us to deal with. Dorian risked a glance at Adian, but his face was hard, calculating, ever the general, fixed on the dead queen now standing in this room with them. Lysandra was gone. No, in ghost leopard form, slinking through the shadows. Rowan's hand was resting casually on his sword, though Dorian's own magic swept the room and realized the weapon was to be the physical distraction from the magical blow he'd deal Elena, if she so much as looked funny at Aelin. Indeed, a hard shield of air now lay between the two queens and sealed this room, too. Elena shook her head, her silver hair flowing.
You were meant to retrieve the word keys before Erewhon could get this far.
Well, I didn't, Aelin snapped. Forgive me if you weren't entirely clear on your directions.
Elena said, I do not have time to explain, but know it was the only choice. To save us, to save Irelia. It was the only choice I could make.
And for all their snapping at each other, the queen exposed her palms to Aelin.
Deanna and my father spoke true. I'd thought it was broken. But if they told you to find the lock...
She bit her lip.
Aelin said, Brannon said to go to the stone marshes of Eelway to find the lock. Where, precisely, in the marshes?
There was once a great city in the heart of the marshes,
Elena breathed.
It is now half drowned on the plain. In a temple at its center, we laid the remnants of the lock. I didn't. My father attained the lock at terrible cost. The cost of my mother's body, her mortal life. A lock for the word keys to seal shut the gate and bind the keys inside them forever. I did not understand what it had been intended for. My father never told me about any of it until it was too late. All I knew was that the lock was only able to be used once. Its power capable of sealing anything we wished. So I stole it. I used it for myself, for my people. I have been paying for that crime since.
You used it to seal Erewhon in his tomb,
Aelin said quietly. The pleading faded from Elena's face.
My friends died in the Valley of the Black Mountains that day, so I might have the chance to stop him. I heard their screaming, even in the heart of Erewhon's camp. I will not apologize for trying to end the slaughter so that the survivors could have a future. So you could have a future.
So you used the lock, then chucked it into a ruin?
We placed it inside the holy city on the plain, to be a commemoration of the lives lost. But a great cataclysm rocked the land decades later, and the city sank. The marsh water flowed in, and the lock was forgotten. No one ever retrieved it. Its power had already been used. It was just a bit of metal and glass.
And now it's not?
If both my father and Deanna mentioned it, it must be vital in stopping Erewhon.
Forgive me if I do not trust the word of a goddess who tried to use me like a puppet to blow this town into smithereens.
Her methods are roundabout, but she likely meant you no harm.
Bullshit.
Elena flickered again.
Get to the stone marshes. Find the lock.
I told Brannon, and I'll tell you, we have more pressing matters at hand.
My mother died to forge that lock,
Elena snapped, eyes blazing bright.
She let go of her mortal body so that she could forge the lock for my father. I was the one who broke the promise for how it was to be used.
Aelin blinked, and Dorian wondered if he should indeed be worried when even she was speechless. But Aelin only whispered,
Who was your mother?
Dorian ransacked his memory, all his history lessons on his royal house, but couldn't recall. Elena made a sound that might have been a sob, her image fading into cobwebs in moonlight.
She who loved my father best, she who blessed him with such mighty gifts, and then bound herself in a mortal body and offered him the gift of her heart.
Aelin's arms slackened at her sides. Adian blurted, Shit. Elena laughed humorlessly as she said to Aelin,
Why do you think you burn so brightly? It is not just Brannon's blood that is in your veins, but Mala's.
Aelin breathed,
Mala Firebringer was your mother.
Elena was already gone. Adian said,
Honestly, it's a miracle you two didn't kill each other.
Dorian didn't bother to correct him that it was technically impossible, given that one of them was already dead. Rather, he weighed all that the queen had said and demanded. Rowan, remaining silent, seemed to be doing the same.
Lysandra sniffed around the blood marks, as if testing for whatever remnants of the ancient queen might be around. Aelin stared out the open balcony doors, eyes hooded and mouth a tight line. She unfurled her fist and examined the eye of Elena, still held in her palm. The clock struck 1 in the morning. Slowly, Aelin turned to them. To him.
Mala's blood flows in our veins,
she said hoarsely, fingers closing around the eye before she slipped it into the shirt's pocket. He blinked, realizing that it indeed did. That perhaps both of them had been so considerably gifted because of it. Dorian said to Rowan, if only because he might have heard or witnessed something in all his travels,
is it truly possible for a god to become mortal like that?
Rowan, who had been watching Aelin a bit warily, twisted to him.
I've never heard of such a thing, but Fae have given up their immortality to bind their lives to that of their mortal mates.
Dorian had the distinct feeling Aelin was deliberately examining a spot on her shirt.
It's certainly possible Mala found a way to do it.
It's not just possible,
Aelin murmured.
She did it. That pit of power I uncovered today. That was from Mala herself.
Elena might be many things, but she wasn't lying about that. Lysandra shifted back into her human form, swaying enough that she set herself down on the bed before Adian could move to steady her.
So, what do we do now?
She asked, her voice gravelly.
Erewhon's fleet squats in the Gulf of Oro. Maeve sails for Eelway. But neither knows that we possess this word key or that this lock exists, and lies directly between their forces.
For a heartbeat, Dorian felt like a useless fool as they all, including him, looked to Aelin. He was king of Otterlin, he reminded himself, equal to her. Even if his lands and people had been stolen, his capital captured. But Aelin rubbed her eyes with her thumb and forefinger, loosing a long breath.
I really, really hate that old windbag.
She lifted her head, surveying them all, and said simply,
we sail for the Stone Marshes in the morning to hunt down that lock.
Rolf and the Mycenaeans? Adian asked.
He takes half his fleet to find the rest of the Mycenaeans, wherever they're hiding. Then they all sail north to Terrasen.
Rifthold lies between here and there, with wyverns patrolling it,
Adian countered.
And this plan depends on if we can trust Rolf to actually follow through on his promise.
Rolf knows how to stay out of range,
Rowan said.
We have little choice but to trust him. And he honored the promise he made to Aelin regarding the slaves 2.5 years ago.
No doubt why Aelin had made him confirm it so thoroughly.
And the other half of Rolf's fleet? Adian pushed.
Some remain to hold the archipelago, Aelin said, and some come with us to Eelway.
You can't fight Maeve's armada with a fraction of Rolf's fleet,
Adian said, crossing his arms. Dorian bit back his own agreement, leaving the general to it.
Let alone Morath's forces.
I'm not going there to pick a fight, was all Aelin said.
And that was that. They dispersed then, Aelin and Rowan slipping off to their own room. Dorian lay awake, even when his companion's breathing became deep and slow. He mulled over each word Elena had uttered. Mulled over that long-ago appearance of Gavin, who had awoken him to stop Aelin from opening that portal. Perhaps Gavin had done it not to spare Aelin from damnation, but to keep those waiting, cold-eyed gods from seizing her, as Deanna had today. He tucked the speculation away to consider when he was less prone to leaping to conclusions. But the threads lay in a lattice across his mind, in hues of red and green and gold and blue, glimmering and thrumming, whispering their secrets in languages not spoken in this world. An hour past dawn, they departed Skull's Bay on the swiftest ship Rolf could spare. Rolf didn't bother to say goodbye, already preoccupied with readying his fleet, before they sailed out of the sparkling harbor and into the lush archipelago beyond. He did grant Aelin one parting gift, vague coordinates for the lock. His map had found it, or rather the general location. Some sort of wards must be placed around it, the captain warned them, if his tattoo could not pinpoint its resting place. But it was better than nothing, Dorian supposed. Aelin had grumbled as much. Rowan circled high above in hawk form, scouting behind and ahead. Fenris and Gavriel were at the oars, helping row them out of the harbor, Adian doing so as well, at a comfortable distance from his father. Dorian himself stood at the wheel beside the surly short captain, an older woman who had no interest in speaking to him, king or not. Lysandra swam in the surf below in some form or another, guarding them from any threats beneath the surface. But Aelin stood alone on the prow, her golden hair unbound and flowing behind her, so still that she might have been the twin to the figurehead mere feet beneath. The rising sun cast her in shimmering gold, no hint of the moonfire that had threatened to destroy them all. But even as the queen stood undimming before the shadows of the world, a lick of cold traced the contours of Dorian's heart, and he wondered if Aelin was somehow watching the archipelago, and the seas, and the skies, as if she might never see them again. 3 days later, they were nearly out of the archipelago's strangling grasp. Dorian was again at the helm, Aelin at the prow, the others scattered on various rounds of scouting and resting. His magic felt it before he did. A sense of awareness, of warning and awakening. He scanned the horizon. The Fey warriors fell silent before the others. It looked like a cloud at first, a wind-tossed little cloud on the horizon. Then a large bird. When the sailors began rushing for their weapons, Dorian's mind at last spat out a name for the beast that swept toward them on shimmering, wide wings. Wyvern. There was only one, and only one rider atop it. A rider who did not move, whose white hair was unbound, listing toward the side, as the rider now was. The wyvern dropped lower, skimming over the water. Lysandra was instantly ready, waiting for the queen's order to shift into whatever form would fight it. No. The word ripped from Dorian's lips before he could think. But then it came out over and over as the wyvern and rider sailed closer to the ship. The witch was unconscious, her body leaning to the side because she was not awake, because that was blue blood all over her. Don't shoot! Don't shoot! Dorian was roaring the order as he hurtled for where Fenris had drawn his longbow, a black-tipped arrow aimed at the witch's exposed neck. His words were swallowed by the shouting of the sailors and their captain. Dorian's magic swelled as he unsheathed Damaris. But then Aelin's voice cut over the fray. Hold your fire! All of them halted. The wyvern sailed close, then banked, circling the boat. Blue blood crusted the beast's scarred sides. So much blood. The witch was barely in the saddle. Her tan face was leached of color, her lips paler than whalebone. The wyvern completed its circle, sweeping lower this time, readying to land as near the boat as possible. Not to attack, but for help. One moment, the Wyvern was soaring smoothly over the cobalt waves. Then the witch listed so far that her body seemed to go boneless, as if in that heartbeat, when help was mere feet away. Whatever luck had kept her astride at last abandoned her. Silence fell on the ship, as Manon Blackbeak tumbled from her saddle, falling through wind and spindrift, and hit the water. Part 2. Fireheart. Chapter 40. The smoke had been stinging Aleed's eyes for the better part of the gray, muggy morning. Just farmers burning fields left to fallow, Molly had claimed, so the ashes might fertilize the earth for next year's harvest. They had to be miles away, but the smoke and ash would travel far on the brisk northward wind, the wind that led home to Terrison. But they weren't headed to Terrison. They were headed due east, straight toward the coast. Soon she'd have to cut northward. They had passed through one town, only one, and its denizens had already been fatigued of roving carnivals and performers. Even with the night barely underway, Aleed already knew they would likely only make enough money to cover their expenses for staying. She had attracted a grand total of 4 customers to her little tent so far, mostly young men looking to know which of the village girls fancied them, barely noticing that Aleed, beneath the makeup pasted thick as cream on her face, was no older than they were. They'd scampered off when their friends had rushed by, whispering through the star-painted flaps that a swordsman was putting on the show of a lifetime, and his arms were nearly the size of tree trunks. Aleed had glowered, both at the feckless young men who vanished, one without paying, and at Lorkin for stealing the show. She waited all of 2 minutes before shoving out of the tent, the enormous, ridiculous headdress Molly had plunked on her hair snagging on the flaps. Bits of dangling beads and charms hung from the arching crest, and Aleed batted them out of her eyes, nearly tripping over her matching blood-red robes as she went to see what all the fuss was about. If the young men of the town had been impressed by Lorkin's muscles, it was nothing on what those muscles were doing to the young women. And older women, Aleed realized, not bothering to squeeze through the tightly packed crowd before the makeshift stage on which Lorkin stood, juggling and throwing swords and knives. Lorkin was not a natural performer. No, he had the gall to actually look bored up there, bordering on outright sullen. But what he lacked in charm, he made up for with his shirtless, oiled body. And holy gods, Lorkin made the young men who had visited her tent look like children. He balanced and hurled his weapons as if they were nothing, and she had the feeling the warrior was merely going through one of his daily exercise routines. But the crowd still oohed and awed at every twist and toss and catch, and coins still trickled into the pan at the edge of the stage. With the torches around him, Lorkin's dark hair seemed to swallow the light, his onyx eyes flat and dull. Aleed wondered if he was contemplating the murder of everyone drooling over him like dogs around a bone. She couldn't blame him. A trickle of sweat slid through the crisp spattering of dark hair on his sculpted chest. Aleed watched, a bit transfixed, as that bead of sweat wended down the muscled grooves of his stomach. Lower. No better than those ogling women, she said to herself, about to head back into her tent, when Molly observed from beside her. Your husband could just be sitting up there, fixing your stockings, and women would empty their pockets for the chance to stare at him.
He had that effect wherever we went with our former carnival, Aleed lied.
Molly clicked her tongue.
You're lucky,
she murmured, as Lorkin hurled his sword high in the air, and people gasped,
that he still looks at you the way he does.
Elide wondered if Lorkin would look at her at all if she told him what her name was, who she was, what she carried. He'd slept on the floor of the tent each night. Not that she'd ever once bothered to offer him the roll. He usually came in after she'd fallen asleep, and left before she awoke. To do what, she had no idea. Perhaps exercise, since his body was like that. Lorkin chucked three knives in the air, bowing without one bit of humility or amusement to the crowd. They gasped again as the blades aimed for his exposed spine. But in an easy, beautiful maneuver, Lorkin rolled, catching each blade, one after another. The crowd cheered, and Lorkin coolly looked at his pan of coins. More copper and some silver flowed like the patter of rain. Molly let out a low laugh. Desire and fear can loosen any purse strings. A sharp glance. Shouldn't you be in your tent? Elide didn't bother responding as she left, and could have sworn she felt Lorkin's gaze narrow on her, on the headdress and swaying beads, on the long, voluminous robes. She kept going, and endured a few more young men and some young women asking about their love lives, before she found herself again alone in that silly tent, the dark only illuminated by dangling crystal orbs with tiny candles inside. She was waiting for Molly to finally shout the carnival was over, when Lorkin shouldered through the flaps, wiping his face with a scrap of fabric that was most definitely not his shirt. Elide said, "Molly will be begging you to stay, you realize." He slid into the folding chair before her round table.
"Is that your professional prediction?"
She swatted at a strand of beads that swayed into her eyes.
"Did you sell your shirt, too?"
Lorkin gave a feral grin.
"Got 10 coppers from a farmer's wife for it."
Elide scowled.
"That's disgusting."
"Money is money. I suppose you don't need to worry about it with all the gold you've got stashed."
Elide held his stare, not bothering to look pleasant.
"You're in a rare good mood."
"Having 2 women and 1 man offer a spot in their beds tonight will do that to a person."
"Then why are you here?"
It came out sharper than she intended. He surveyed the hanging orbs, the woven carpet, the black tablecloth, and then her hands, scarred and calloused and small, gripping the edge of the table.
"Wouldn't it ruin your ruse if I slipped off into the night with someone else? You'd be expected to throw me out on my ass, to be heartbroken and raging for the rest of your time here."
"You might as well enjoy yourself," she said. "You're going to leave soon anyway."
"So are you,"
he reminded her. Elide tapped a finger on the tablecloth, the rough fabric scratching against her skin.
"What is it?"
he demanded, as if it were an inconvenience to be polite.
"Nothing."
It wasn't nothing, though. She knew why she'd been delaying that turn northward. The inevitable departure from this group and final trek on her own. She could barely make an impact at a backwater carnival. What the hell would she do in a court of such powerful people, especially without being able to read? While Aelin could destroy kings and save cities, what the hell would she do to prove her worth? Wash their clothes? Clean their dishes?
"Marion,"
he said roughly. She looked up, surprised to find him still there. Lorkin's dark eyes were unreadable in the dimness.
"You had plenty of young men unable to stop staring at you tonight. Why not have some fun with them?"
"Why?"
she snapped. The thought of a stranger touching her, of some faceless, nameless man pawing at her in the dark. Lorkin stilled. He said too calmly,
"When you were in Morath, did someone..."
"No."
She knew what he meant.
No, it didn't get that far.
But the memory of those men touching her, laughing at her nakedness, she shoved it away.
I've never been with a man. Never had the chance or the interest.
He cocked his head, his dark silken hair sliding over his face.
Do you prefer women?
She blinked at him.
No, I don't think so. I don't know what I prefer. Again, I've never had the opportunity to feel that.
Desire, lust, she didn't know. And she didn't know how or why they'd wound up talking about this.
Why?
And with all of Lorkin's considerable focus honed in on her, with the way he'd glanced at her red-painted mouth,
Elid wanted to tell him
about the tower and Vernon and her parents, about why if she were ever to feel desire, it'd be a result of trusting someone so much that those horrors faded away. A result of knowing they would fight tooth and claw to keep her free and never lock her up or hurt her or leave her. Elid opened her mouth. Then the screaming started. Lorkin didn't know why the hell he was in Marion's ridiculous little oracle's tent. He needed to wash, needed to clean away the sweat and oil and feel of all those ogling eyes on him. But he'd spotted Marion in the crowd while he'd finished up his piss-poor performance. He hadn't seen her earlier in the evening before she'd put on that headdress and those robes, but maybe it was the cosmetics, the heavy kohl around her eyes, the way the red-painted lips made her mouth look like a fresh piece of fruit. But he'd noticed her. Noticed the way the men had spotted her, too. Some had outright gawked, wonder and lust written across their bodies, as Marion lingered, oblivious, at the edge of the crowd, and watched Lorkin instead. Beautiful. After a few weeks of eating, of safety, the terrified, gaunt young woman had somehow gone from pretty to beautiful. He'd ended his performance sooner than he'd intended, and by the time he looked up again, Marion was gone. Like a god's damned dog, he'd picked up her scent among the crowd and followed her back to this tent. In the shadows and glowing lights within, with the headdress and dangling beads and dark red robes, the oracle incarnate, serene, exquisite, and utterly forbidden. And he'd been so focused on cursing himself for staring at that ripe, sinful mouth while she admitted she was still untouched, that he hadn't detected anything amiss until the screaming started. No, he'd been too busy contemplating what sounds might come from that full mouth if he slowly, gently taught her the art of the bedroom. The attack, Lorkin supposed, was Hellas's way of telling him to keep his cock in his pants and mind out of the gutter.
Get under a wagon and stay there, he snapped, before hurtling out of the tent.
He didn't wait to see if she obeyed. Marion was smart. She knew she'd stand a better chance at survival if she listened to him and found shelter. Lorkin loosed his gift through the panicking carnival sight, a wave of dark, terrible power sweeping out in a ripple, then rushing back to tell him what it sensed. His power was gleeful, breathless in a way he knew too well. Death. At one end of the field lay the outskirts of the little town. At the other, a copse of trees and endless night. And wings. Towering sinewy forms plunged down from the skies. His magic picked up four. Four Ilken as they landed, claws out and bearing those flesh-shredding teeth. The leathery wings, it seemed, marked them as some slight variation of the ones who had tracked them in Oakwald. A variation, or a refining of an already ruthless hunter. People ran, screaming, toward the town, toward the cover of the dark fields beyond.
Those distant fires had not been set by farmers to burn their idle fields. They had been set to cloud the skies, to hide the scent of these beasts. From him, or any other gifted warriors.
Marion.
They were hunting Marion. The carnival was in chaos. The horses were shrieking and bucking. Lorcan plunged toward where the four Ilken had landed in the heart of the camp, right where he'd been performing minutes before, in time to see one land atop a fleeing young man and flip him onto his back. The young man was still screaming for gods who would not answer, as the Ilken leaned down, flicking free a long talon, and opened up his belly in a smooth swipe. He was still screaming when the Ilken lowered his mutilated face and feasted.
What in burning hell are those beasts?
It was Ombriel, a longsword out, and gripped in a way that told him she knew how to wield it. Nick came thundering up behind her, two rough, near-rusted blades in his meaty hands. Soldiers from Morath, was all Lorcan supplied. Nick was eyeing the blade and hatchet Lorcan had drawn, and he didn't think to pretend to not know how to use either, to be a simple man from the wilds, as he said with cold precision,
They're naturally able to cut through most magic, and only beheading will keep them down.
They're nearly 8 feet,
Ombriel said, face pale. Lorcan left them to their assessments in fear, stepping into the ring of light in the heart of the camp, as the four Ilken finished playing with the young man. The human was still alive, silently mouthing pleas for help. Lorcan lashed out with his power, and could have sworn the young man had gratitude in his eyes, as death kissed him in greeting. The Ilken looked up as one, hissing softly. Blood slid from their teeth. Lorcan tunneled into his power, preparing to distract and addle them, if their resistance to magic held true. Perhaps Marion would have time to run. The Ilken who had ripped open the belly of the young man said to him, laughter dancing on its gray tongue,
Are you the one in charge?
Lorcan simply said,
Yes.
It told him enough. They did not know who he was, his role in Marion's escape. The four Ilken smiled.
We seek a girl. She murdered our kin, and several others.
They blamed her for the Ilken's death those weeks ago? Or was it an excuse to further their own ends?
We tracked her to the Acanthus Crossing. She may be hiding here, among your people.
A sneer. Lorcan willed Nick and Ombriel to keep their mouths shut. If they so much as started to reveal to them, the hatchet in his hands would move.
Check another carnival. We've had this crew for months.
She is small,
it went on, those two human eyes flickering,
crippled on one leg.
We don't know anyone like that.
They'd hunt her to the ends of the earth.
Then line up your crew, so we might inspect them.
Make them walk. Look them over. Look for a dark-haired young woman with a limp and whatever other markers her uncle had provided.
You've scared them all away. It might be days before they return. And again,
Lorcan said. Hatchet flicking a bit higher.
There is no one in my caravan who matches such a description.
Behind him, Nick and Ombriel were silent, their terror a reek that shoved itself up his nose. Lorcan willed Marion to remain hidden. The Ilken smiled, the most hideous smile Lorcan had beheld in all his centuries.
We have gold.
Indeed. The Ilken beside it had a hip pouch sagging with it.
Her name is Elide Lochin. Her uncle is Lord of Peranth. He will reward you handsomely to turn her over.
The words hit Lorkin like stones. Marion, Elide, had lied. Had managed to keep him from even sniffing the lie on her. Had used enough truths and her own general fear to keep the scent of it hidden.
"We know no one by such a name," Lorkin said again.
"Pity," the sentinel crooned. "For if you had her in your company, we would have taken her and left. But now..."
The Ilken smiled at its three companions, and their dark wings rustled.
"Now, it seems we have flown a very long way for nothing. And we are very hungry."
Chapter 41 Elide had squeezed herself into a hidden floor compartment in the largest of the wagons and prayed that no one discovered her or began burning things. Her frantic breathing was the only sound. The air grew tight and hot. Her legs trembled and cramped from staying curled in a ball. But still she waited. Still she kept hidden. Lorkin had run out. He'd just run into the fray. She'd fled the tent in time to see four Ilken, winged Ilken, descend upon the camp. She had not lingered long enough to see what happened after. Time passed. Minutes, or perhaps hours, she couldn't tell. She had done this. She had brought these things here, to these people, to the caravan. The screaming grew louder, then faded, then nothing. Lorkin might be dead. Everyone might be dead. Her ears strained, and she tried to quiet her breathing to listen for any sounds of life, of action beyond her small, hot hiding space. No doubt it was usually reserved for smuggling contraband, not at all intended for a human being. She couldn't stay hidden much longer. If the Ilken slaughtered them all, they'd search for any survivors, could likely sniff her out. She would have to make a run for it, have to break out, observe what she could, and sprint for the dark fields and pray no others waited out there. Her feet and calves had gone numb minutes before, and now tingled incessantly. She might very well not even be able to walk, and her stupid, useless leg. She listened again, praying to Aneth to turn the Ilken's attention elsewhere. Only silence greeted her. No more screaming. Now. She should go now, while she had the cover of darkness. Elide did not give her fear another heartbeat to whisper its poison into her blood. She had survived Morath, survived weeks alone. She'd make it. She had to make it. And she wouldn't at all mind being the Queen's god's-damned dishwasher, if it meant she could live. Elide uncoiled, shoulders aching as she quietly eased the trapdoor up, the little area rug sliding back. She scanned the interior of the wagon, the empty benches on either side, then studied the night beckoning beyond. Light spilled from the camp behind her, but ahead. A sea of blackness. The field was perhaps 30 feet away. Elide winced as the wood groaned, while she hefted the trapdoor high enough for her to slither belly down over the floorboards. But her robe snagged, yanking her into a stop. Elide gritted her teeth, tugging blindly, but it had caught inside the crawlspace. "Aneth, save her."
"Tell me," drawled a deep male voice behind her, from near the driver's seat. "What would you have done if I were an Ilken soldier?"
Relief turned her bones to liquid, and Elide held in her sob. She twisted to find Lorkin covered in black blood, sitting on the bench behind the driver's seat, legs spread before him. His axe and sword lay discarded behind him, coated in that black blood as well, and Lorkin idly chewed on a long stalk of wheat as he gazed at the canvas wall of the wagon.
"The first thing I might have done in your place," Lorkin mused, still not looking at her, would have been to ditch the robe. You'd fall flat on your face if you ran, and the red would be as good as ringing the dinner bell. She tugged at the robe again, and the fabric ripped at last. Scowling, she patted where it had come free and found a loose bit of wood paneling.
The second thing I might have done, Lorcan went on, not even bothering to wipe away the blood splattered on his face, is tell me the god's damned truth. Did you know those Ilken beasts love to talk with the right encouragement? And they told me some very, very interesting things.
Those dark eyes at last slid to her, utterly vicious.
But you didn't tell me the truth, did you, Elide?
Her eyes were wide. Her face leached of color beneath the cosmetics. She'd lost the headdress somewhere, and her dark sheet of hair slid free of some of its pins as she climbed from the hidden compartment. Lorcan watched every movement, assessing and weighing and debating what exactly to do with her. Liar. Cunning little liar. Elide Lorcan, rightful Lady of Peranth, crawled out, slamming the trap door shut and glaring at him from where she knelt on the floor. He glared right back.
Why should I have trusted you, she said with impressive coldness, when you were stalking me for days in the forest? Why should I have told you a thing about me when you could have sold me to the highest bidder?
His body ached. His head throbbed from the slaughter he'd barely managed to survive. The Ilken had gone down, but not willingly. And the one he'd kept alive, the one Nick and Ombriel had begged him to kill and be done with, had told him very little, actually. But Lorcan had decided his wife didn't need to know that. Decided it was time to see what she might reveal if he let some lies of his own fool her. Elide glanced at his weapons, at the reeking blood coating him like oil.
You killed them all.
He lowered the wheat stalk from his mouth.
Do you think I'd be sitting here if I hadn't?
Elide Lorcan wasn't some mere human trying to return to her homeland and serve her queen. She was a royal-blooded lady who wanted to get back to that fire-breathing bitch in the north to offer whatever aid she could. She and Aelin would be well-suited for each other, he decided. The sweet-faced liar and the insufferable, haughty princess. Elide slumped onto the bench, massaging her feet and calves.
I'm risking my neck for you, he said too quietly. And yet you decided not to tell me that your uncle isn't just a mere commander at Morath, but Erewhon's right hand. And you are his prized possession.
I told you enough of the truth. Who I am makes no difference, and I am no one's possession.
His temper yanked at the leash he'd been careful to keep short before tracking her scent to this wagon. Outside, the others were hurriedly packing, readying to flee into the night before the villagers decided to blame them for the disaster.
It does make a difference who you are. With your queen on the move, your uncle knows she'd pay a steep price to get you back. You are not a mere breeding asset. You are a negotiation tool. You might very well be what brings that bitch to her knees.
Rage flashed in her fine-boned face. You keep plenty of secrets too, Lorcan.
She spat his name like a curse.
And I still haven't been able to decide if I find it insulting or amusing that you think I'm too stupid to notice. That you thought I was some fear-addled girl, too grateful for the presence of such a strong, brooding warrior to even question why you were there, or what you wanted, or what your stake in all this is. I gave you exactly what you wanted to see. A lost young woman in need of help,
perhaps a bit skilled at lying and deceit, but ultimately not worth more than a few seconds' consideration. And you, in all your immortal arrogance, didn't think twice. Why should you, when humans are so useless? Why should you even bother, when you planned to abandon me the moment you got what you needed?
Lorcan blinked, bracing his feet on the floor. She didn't back down an inch. He couldn't remember the last time anyone had spoken to him like that.
I would be careful what you say to me.
Elide gave him a hateful little smile.
Or what? You'll sell me to Morath, use me as your ticket in.
I hadn't thought to do that, but thank you for the idea.
Her throat bobbed, the only sign of her fear. And she said clearly and without a hint of hesitation,
If you try to bring me to Morath, I will end my own life before you can carry me over the Keep's bridge.
It was the threat, the promise that checked his anger, his utter rage that she had indeed played into his expectations of her, his arrogance and prejudices. He said carefully,
What is it that you're carrying that makes them hunt you so relentlessly? Not your royal blood, not your magic and use for breeding, the object you carry with you. What is it?
Perhaps it was a night for truth. Perhaps death hovered close enough to make her a bit reckless. But Elide said,
It's a gift for Selena Sardothian, from a woman kept imprisoned in Morath who had waited a long time to repay her for a past kindness. More than that, I don't know.
A gift for an assassin, not the queen. Perhaps nothing of note, but...
Let me see it.
No.
They stared each other down again, and Lorcan knew that if he wanted, he could wait until she was asleep, take it for himself and vanish, see what might make her so protective of it. But he knew, some small, stupid part of him knew, that if he took from this woman who had already had too much stolen from her, he didn't know if there was any coming back from that. He'd done such despicable, vicious things over the centuries and hadn't thought twice. He'd reveled in them, relished them, the cruelty. But this? There was a line. Somehow there was a God's damned line here. She seemed to pick up on his decision, with whatever gift she had. Her shoulders slumped, and she stared blankly at the canvas wall as the sounds of their group now grew closer, their urging to hurry and pack, leave what could be spared. Elide said quietly,
Marion was my mother's name. She died defending Aelin Galathinius from her assassin. My mother bought Aelin time to run, to get away, so she could one day return to save us all. My uncle, Vernon, watched and smiled as my father, the Lord of Peranth, was executed outside our castle. Then he took my father's title and lands and home. And for the next 10 years, my uncle locked me in the highest tower of Peranth Castle, with only my nursemaid for company. When I broke my foot and ankle, he did not trust healers enough to let them treat it. He kept bars on the tower windows to keep me from killing myself, and shackled my ankles to keep me from running. I left for the first time in a decade when he shoved me into a prison wagon and dragged me down to Morath. There, he made me work as a servant, for the humiliation and terror he delights in. I planned and dreamed of escaping every day, and when the time came, I took my chance. I did not know about the Ilken, had only heard rumors of fell things being bred in the mountains beyond the keep. I have no lands, no money, no army to offer Aelin Galathinius. but I will find her and help her in whatever way I can. If only to keep just one girl, just one, from ever enduring what I did.
He let the truth in her words sink into him, let them adjust his view of her, his plans.
Lorkin said roughly,
I am over 500 years old. I am bloodsworn to Queen Maeve of the Fae, and I am her second in command. I have done great and terrible things in her name, and I will do more before death comes to claim me. I was born a bastard on the streets of Dorinel, ran wild with the other discarded children until I realized my talents were different. Maeve noticed, too. I can kill faster. I can sense when death is near. I think my magic is death, given to me by Hellas himself. I am in these lands on behalf of my queen, though I came without her permission. She might very well hunt me down and kill me for it. If her sentinels arrive looking for me, it is in your best interest to pretend not to know who and what I am.
There was more, but
Elide had remaining secrets, too. They'd offered each other enough for now.
No fear tainted her scent. Not even a trace of it. All Elide said was, Do you have a family?
No.
Do you have friends?
No.
His cabal of warriors didn't count. God's damned Whitethorn hadn't seemed to care when he abandoned them to serve Aelin Galathinius. Fenris made no secret he hated the bond. Vaughn was barely around. He couldn't stand Gavriel's unbreakable restraint. And Connell was too busy rutting Maeve like an animal most of the time.
Elide angled her head, her hair sliding across her face.
He almost lifted a hand to brush it back and read her dark eyes. But his hands were covered in that filthy blood, and he had the feeling Elide Locken did not wish to be touched unless she asked to be.
Then,
she murmured,
you and I are the same in that regard, at least.
No family. No friends.
It hadn't seemed quite so pathetic until she said it, until he suddenly saw himself through her eyes.
But Elide shrugged, rising to her feet as Molly's voice barked from nearby.
You should clean up. You look like a warrior again.
He wasn't sure if she meant it as a compliment.
Nick and Ombriel, unfortunately, realized you and I are perhaps not what we seem.
Alarm flashed in her eyes.
Should we leave?
No. They'll keep our secrets.
If only because they'd seen Lorkin lay into those Ilkin, and knew precisely what he could do to them if they so much as breathed wrong in their direction.
We can stay a while yet, until we get clear of this.
Elide nodded, her limp deep as she headed for the back of the wagon. She sat on the edge before climbing off, her wrecked ankle too weak and painful to ever jump. Yet she moved with quiet dignity, hissing a little as her foot made contact with the ground. Lorkin watched her limp into the night without so much as a backward glance at him. And he wondered what the hell he was doing.
Chapter 42. Death smelled like salt and blood and wood and rot. And it hurt.
Darkness embrace her. It hurt like hell. The ancient ones had lied that it cured all ills, if the slice of pain across her abdomen was any indication. Not to mention the pounding headache, the sheer dryness of her mouth, the burning sting in the other cut on her arm. Perhaps the darkness was another world, another realm. Perhaps she'd gone to the hell realm the humans so feared.
She hated death. And death could go to hell, too.
Manon Blackbeak cracked open eyelids that were too heavy, too burning, and squinted against the flickering lantern light that swayed upon the wood panels of the room in which she lay. Not a real bedroom, she realized by the reek of salt and rocking and creaking of the world around her. A cabin. On a ship. A small, dingy one, with barely space for this bed. A porthole too small for her shoulders to even squeeze through. She bolted upright. Abraxos. Where was Abraxos? Relax, drawled a too familiar female voice from the shadowed space near the foot of the bed. Pain flared in Manon's belly, a delayed response to her sudden movement, and she glanced between the white bandages that now scratched against her fingers and the young queen lounging in the chair by the door, glanced between the woman and the chains now around Manon's wrists, around her ankles, anchored into the walls with what appeared to be freshly drilled holes. Looks like you owe me a life debt once more, Blackbeak, Aelin Galathinia said, cold humor in her turquoise eyes.
Elide. Had Elide made it here?
Your fussy nursemaid of a wyvern is fine, by the way. I don't know how you wound up with a sweet thing like that for a mount, but he's content to sprawl in the sun on the foredeck. Can't say it makes the sailors particularly happy, especially cleaning up after him.
Find somewhere safe, she'd told Abraxos. Had he somehow found the queen?
Somehow known this was the only place she might stand a chance of surviving? Aelin braced her feet on the floor, boots thudding softly. There was a frank sort of impatience with any sort of bullshit that had not been there the last time Manon had seen the woman. As if the warrior who had laughed her way through their battle atop Temis's temple had lost a bit of that wicked amusement, but gained more of the cunning cruelty. Manon's belly gave a throb of pain that made her bite her lip to keep from hissing. Whoever gave you that wound wasn't joking, the queen said. Trouble at home. It wasn't the queen's business, or anyone else's.
Let me heal, and then I'll be on my way, Manon rasped, her tongue a dried, heavy husk.
Oh, no, Aelin purred. You're not going anywhere. Your mount may do whatever he pleases, but you are now officially our prisoner. Manon's head started spinning, but she forced herself to say,
Our.
A knowing little smile. Then the queen rose gracefully. Her hair was longer, face leaner, those turquoise eyes hard and haunted. The queen said simply, Here are the rules, Blackbeak. You try to escape, you die. You hurt anyone, you die. You somehow bring any of us into trouble. I think you get where I'm going with this. You step one foot out of line and I'll finish what we started that day in the forest, life debt or no. This time I don't need steel to do it. As she spoke, gold flames seemed to flicker in her eyes. And Manon realized with no small thrill, even with her pain, that the queen could indeed end her before she'd get close enough to kill. Aelin turned for the door, her scarred hand on the knob. I found iron splinters in your belly before I healed you. I suggest you don't lie to whoever can tolerate being around you long enough to get the full story. She jerked her chin toward the floor. A pitcher and cup lay there. Water's next to the bed. If you can reach it. Then she was gone. Manon listened to her steady footsteps fade. No other voices or sounds beyond the lap of waves against the ship, the groan of the wood, and gulls. They had to still be within range of the coast then.
Sailing to where? She'd have to figure that out. Once she healed. Once she got out of these irons. Once she got onto Abraxos. But to go where? To whom? There was no Eri to receive her. No clan who would shield her from her grandmother. And the 13? Where were they now? Had they been hunted down? Manon's stomach burned, but she reached for the water. Pain lashed her hard enough that she gave up after a heartbeat. They had heard, no doubt, what she was. The 13 had heard. Not just a half-blooded Kraken, but the last Kraken queen. And her sister. Her half-sister. Manon stared at the shadowed wooden ceiling. She could feel that Kraken's blood on her hands. And her cape. That red cape was draped over the edge of the bed. Her sister's cape. That her grandmother had made her wear, knowing who it belonged to, knowing whose throat Manon had slit. No longer the Blackbeak heir, Kraken blood or no. Despair curled like a cat around the pain in Manon's belly. She was no one, and nothing. She did not remember falling asleep. The witch slept for 3 days after Aelin reported that she had awakened. Dorian went into that cramped cabin with Rowan and the Queen every time they healed a little bit more of her, observing the way their magic worked, but not daring to try it on the unconscious Blackbeak. Even unconscious, Manon's every breath, every twitch, was a reminder that she was a born predator, her agonizingly beautiful face a careful mask to lure the unwary to their doom. It felt fitting, somehow, considering that they were likely sailing to their own doom. As Rolf's two ships had escorted them down the coast of Eelway, they'd kept well away from the shore. A wicked storm had them mooring among the small cluster of islands off Lariba's waters, and they'd only survived thanks to Rowan's own winds shielding them. Most of them had still spent the entirety of it with their head in a bucket, himself included. They were nearing Bunjali now, and Dorian had tried and failed not to think of his dead friend with every league closer to the lovely city. Tried and failed not to consider if Nehemia would have been with them on this very ship, had things not gone so terribly wrong. Tried and failed not to contemplate if that touch she'd once given him, the word mark she'd sketched over his chest, had somehow awakened that power of his. If it had been a curse as much as a blessing. He hadn't had the nerve to ask what Aelin was feeling, though he found her frequently staring toward the coast, even if they couldn't see it, even if they wouldn't get close. Another week, perhaps less if Rowan's magic helped, would have them at the eastern edge of the stone marshes. And once they were in range, they'd have to trust Rolf's vague directions to guide them. And avoid Melisande's armada. Erewhon's armada now, he supposed, waiting just around the peninsula in the Gulf of Oro. But for now, Dorian was on watch in Manon's room, none of them taking any risks where the Blackbeak heir was concerned. He cleared his throat as her eyelids shifted, her dark lashes bobbing up, then lifting wholly. Gold sleep-murky eyes met his.
"Hello, witchling," he said.
Her full, sensuous mouth tightened slightly, either in a repressed grimace or smile, he couldn't tell. But she sat up, her moon-white hair sliding forward, her chains clanking.
"Hello, princeling," she said.
Gods, her voice was like sandpaper. He glanced at the water jug.
"Care for a drink?"
She had to be parched. They'd barely been able to get a trickle down her throat, not wanting to risk her choking or freeing those iron teeth from wherever she kept them. Manon studied the pitcher, then him.
Am I your prisoner, too?
My life debt is paid, he said simply.
You're nothing to me at all.
What happened? She rasped.
An order, and one he allowed her to make. But he filled the glass, trying not to look like he was calculating her range in those chains as he handed it to her. No sign of her iron nails as her slim fingers wrapped around the cup. She winced slightly, winced a bit more as she lifted it to her still pale lips, and drank, and drank. She drained the glass. Dorian silently refilled it for her. Once, twice, thrice. When she at last finished, he said,
Your wyvern flew straight as an arrow for us. You tumbled off the saddle and into the water barely 50 yards from our ship. How he found us, we don't know. We got you out of the water. Rowan himself had to temporarily bind your stomach on the deck before we could even move you down here. It's a miracle you're not dead from blood loss alone, never mind infection. We had you down here for a week, Aelin and Rowan working on you. They had to cut you open again in some spots to get the bad flesh out. You've been in and out of it since.
Dorian didn't feel like mentioning that he'd been the one who'd jumped into the water. He just acted, as Manon had acted when she'd saved him in his tower. He owed her nothing less. Lysandra in sea dragon form had caught up to them moments later, and he'd held the water-heavy Manon in his arms as he'd climbed onto the shifter's back. The witch had been so pale, and the wound on her stomach. He'd almost lost his breakfast at the sight of it. She looked like a fish who'd been sloppily gutted. Gutted, Aelin had confirmed an hour later, when she held up a small sliver of metal, by someone with very, very sharp iron nails. None of them had mentioned that it might have been punishment for saving him. Manon was assessing the room with eyes quickly clearing.
Where are we? On the sea.
Aelin had ordered he not give her any information about their plans and whereabouts.
Are you hungry?
He asked, wondering what exactly she might eat. Indeed, those gold eyes slashed to his throat.
Really?
He lifted a brow. Her nostrils flared slightly.
Only for sport. Aren't you partially human, at least? Not in the ways that count.
Right, because the other parts, Fae, Volg, it was Volg blood that had shaped the witches. The very prince that had infested him shared blood with her. From the black pit of his memory, images and words slithered out. Of that prince seeing the gold eyes Dorian now met, screeching at him to get away. Eyes of the Volg kings. He said carefully,
So, would you consider yourself more Volg than human, then?
The Volg are my enemy. Erewhon is my enemy.
And does that make us allies?
She revealed no indication either way. Is there a young woman in your company named Elide?
No.
Who in the hell was that?
We've never encountered anyone with that name.
Manon closed her eyes for a heartbeat. Her slender throat bobbed.
Have you heard news of my 13?
You're the first rider in Wyvern we've seen in weeks.
He contemplated why she'd asked, why she'd gone so still.
You don't know if they're alive.
And with those iron shavings in her gut. Manon's voice was flat and cold as death.
Tell Aelin Galathinius not to bother using me for negotiations. The Blackbeak matron will not acknowledge me, either as heir or witch. And all you will get out of it is revealing your precise location.
His magic flickered.
What happened after Rifthold?
Manon lay back down, angling her head away from him. Spindrift from the open porthole caught in her white hair and set it shimmering in the dim cabin.
Everything has a price.
And it was those words, the fact that the witch had turned her face away and seemed to be waiting for death to claim her, that made him croon.
I once told you to find me again. It seems like you couldn't wait to see my handsome face.
Her shoulders stiffened slightly.
I'm hungry.
He smiled slowly. As if she'd heard that smile, Manon glared.
Food.
But there was still an edge, a too fragile edge limning every line of her body. Whatever had happened, whatever she had endured. Dorian draped an arm along the back of his chair.
It's coming in a few minutes.
I'd hate for you to waste away into nothing. It'd be a shame to lose the most beautiful woman in the world so soon into her immortal, wicked life.
I am not a woman,
was all she said. But hot temper laced those molten gold eyes. He gave her an indolent shrug, perhaps only because she was indeed in chains, perhaps because, even though the death she radiated thrilled him, it did not strike a chord of fear.
Witch, woman, as long as the parts that matter are there, what difference does it make?
She eased into a sitting position, disbelief and exhausted outrage on that perfect face. She bared her teeth in a silent snarl. Dorian offered a lazy grin in return.
Believe it or not, this ship has an unnatural number of attractive men and women on board. You'll fit right in. And fit in with the cranky immortals, I suppose.
She glanced toward the door moments before he heard approaching footsteps. They were silent until the knob turned, revealing Adian's frowning face.
Awake, and ready to rip out throats, it seems,
the general said by way of greeting. Dorian rose, taking the tray of what looked to be fish stew from him. He wondered if he should test it for poison from the look Adian was giving Manon. She glared right back at the golden-haired warrior. Adian said,
I would have shot you and your runt of a wyvern clean out of the sky if given my way. Be grateful my queen finds you more useful alive.
Then he was gone. Dorian set the tray within Manon's reach and watched her sniff at it. She took a slow, cautious bite, as if letting it slide into her healing belly and seeing how it settled there, as if indeed testing it for poison. While she waited, Manon said,
You don't give orders on this ship?
It was a focused effort not to bristle.
You know my circumstances. I am now at the mercy of my friends. And the Queen of Terrasen is your friend.
There is no one else I'd want guarding my back.
Other than Kaol, but it was no use even thinking about him. Missing him. Manon at last took another bite of her fish stew. Then another. And another. And he realized she was avoiding speaking to him. Enough so that he asked,
It was your grandmother who did that to you, wasn't it?
Her spoon stilled in the chipped wooden bowl. Slowly,
She turned her face toward him. Unreadable. A face crafted of nightmares and midnight fantasies.
I'm sorry, he admitted. If the cost of saving me that day in Rifthold was this.
Find out if my 13 are alive, Princeling. Do that, and I am yours to command.
Where did you last see them?
Nothing.
She swallowed another spoonful.
He pushed.
Were they present when your grandmother did that to you?
Her shoulders curved a bit, and she scooped another spoonful of cloudy liquid, but didn't sip. The cost of Rifthold was the life of my second. I refused to pay it, so I bought my 13 time to run. The moment I swung my sword at my grandmother, my title, my legion, was forfeit. I lost the 13 while I fled. I do not know if they are alive or if they have been hunted down. Her eyes snapped to his, bright from more than the steam of her stew.
Find them for me. Learn if they live, or if they have returned to the darkness. We're in the middle of the ocean. There won't be news of anything for a while.
She went back to eating.
They are all I have left.
Then I suppose you and I are both heirs without crowns. A humorless snort. Her white hair shifted in the sea breeze. Dorian rose and walked to the door.
I'll do what I can.
And Elide.
Again that name.
Who is she?
But Manon was back at her stew. Just tell Aelin Galathinius that Elide Locken is alive and looking for her. The conversation with the king took everything out of her. Once that food was in her belly, once she'd downed more water, Manon lay back in bed and slept. And slept. And slept. The door banged open at one point, and she had the vague recollection of the Queen of Terrasen, then her general prince, demanding answers about something. Elide, perhaps. But Manon had lain there, half awake, unwilling to think or speak. She wondered if she would have stopped bothering to breathe if her body hadn't done it all on its own. She had not realized how impossible the survival of the 13 might indeed have been until she was practically begging Dorian Havilliard to find them for her. Until she had found herself desperate enough to sell her sword for any news of them. If they even wanted to serve her after everything. A blackbeak. And a kraken. And her parents, murdered by her grandmother. They had promised the world a child of peace, and she had let her grandmother hone her into a child of war. The thoughts swirled and eddied, sapping her strength, muting colors and sounds. She awoke and saw to her needs when necessary, ate when food was left, but she let that heavy, meaningless sleep take hold. Sometimes, Manon dreamed that she was in that room in the Omega, her half-sister's blood on her hands and in her mouth. Sometimes, she stood beside her grandmother, a witch fully grown and not the witchling she'd been at the time, and helped the matron carve up a handsome, bearded man who begged for her life, his offspring's life. Sometimes she flew over a lush green land, the song of a western wind singing her home. Often, the dream was that a great cat, pale and speckled like old snow on granite, sat in the cabin with her, its long tail slashing back and forth when it noticed her glazed attention. Sometimes it was a grinning white wolf, or a calm-eyed golden mountain lion.
Manon wished they'd put their jaws around her throat and crunch down. They never did. So Manon Blackbeak slept. And so she dreamed. Chapter 43. Lorcan was still wondering what the hell he was doing 3 days later. They left that plains town far behind them. But the terror of that night lay draped over the carnival caravan like a heavy blanket. With each mile, the wagons hurried down the roads. The others hadn't wised up to how exactly they'd survived the Ilken. Hadn't realized the Ilken were near impossible to kill, and no mere mortal could have slain one, let alone four. Nick and Ombriel gave him and Elide a wide berth, and only catching their wary examining stares at the dinner campfire every night revealed they were still piecing together who and what he was. Elide kept well away from him, too. They hadn't had a chance to set up their usual tents, thanks to fleeing so quickly. But tonight, safely within the walls of a small plains town, they'd have to share a room at the cheap inn Molly had begrudgingly paid for. It was hard not to watch Elide as she took in the town, then the inn, the keen-eyed observation, the hint of surprise and confusion that sometimes crossed her face. He used a tendril of his magic to keep her foot stabilized. She never commented on it. And sometimes that dark, fell magic of his would brush up against whatever it was she carried, the gift from a dying woman to a hot-headed assassin, and recoil. Lorcan hadn't pushed to see it since that night, though he'd spent a great deal of time contemplating what might have come out of Morath. Collars and rings were likely the start of it. Whitethorn and the Bitch Queen had no idea about the Ilken, perhaps about the majority of horrors Elide had shared with him. He wondered what a wall of wildfire would do to the creatures, wondered if the Ilken were somehow training against Aelin Galathinius's arsenal. If Erewhon was smart, he'd have something in mind. While the others trudged into the ramshackle inn in search of food and rest, Elide informed Molly that she was going on a walk along the river and headed into the cobblestone streets. And though his stomach was grumbling, Lorcan trailed her, ever the husband wishing to guard his beautiful wife in a town that had seen better days, decades. No doubt caused by Otterlin's relentless road-building across the continent, and the fact that this town had been left far from any artery through the land. The thunderstorm he'd scented building on the horizon lumbered toward the stone-wrought town, the light shifting from gold to silver. Within minutes, the thick humidity was washed away by a sweep of welcome coolness. Lorcan gave Elide all of 3 blocks before he fell into step beside her and said,
"It's going to rain."
She slid a flat glance at him.
"I do know what thunder means."
The walled town had been built on either side of a small, half-forgotten river. 2 large water gates on either end demanding tolls to enter the city and tracking the goods that passed through. Old water, fish, and rotting wood reached him before the sight of the muddy, calm waters did. And it was precisely at the edge of the river docks that Elide paused.
"What are you looking for?"
he asked at last, an eye on the darkening skies. The dock workers, sailors, and merchants monitored the clouds, too, as they scurried about. Some lingered to tie up the long, flat-bellied barges and latch down the smooth poles they used to navigate the river. He'd seen a kingdom, perhaps 300 years ago, that relied on barges to sail its goods from one end to another. Its name eluded him, lost to the catacombs of his memory. Lorcan wondered if it still existed, tucked away between 2 mountain ranges on the other side of the world. Elide's bright eyes tracked a group of well-dressed men heading into what looked to be a tavern.
"Storms mean looking for shelter," she murmured.
Shelter means being stuck inside with nothing to do but gossip. Gossip means news from merchants and sailors about the rest of the land.
Those eyes cut to him, dry humor dancing there.
That is what thunder means.
Lorcan blinked as she followed after the men who'd entered the dockside tavern. The first fat drops of the storm plunked onto the moss-speckled cobblestones of the quay. Lorcan followed a lead inside the tavern, some part of him admitting that for all his 500 years of surviving and killing and serving, he'd never quite encountered someone so unimpressed with him. Even God's damned Aelin had some sense of the threat he posed. Maybe living with monsters had stripped away a healthy fear of them. He wondered how Aelin hadn't become one in the process. Lorcan took in the details of the taproom by instinct and training, finding nothing worth a second thought. The reek of the place, unwashed bodies, piss, mold, wet wool, threatened to suffocate him. But in the span of a few moments, Aelin had grabbed herself a table near a cluster of those people from the docks and ordered 2 tankards of ale and whatever was the lunch special. Lorcan slid into the ancient wooden chair beside hers, wondering if the damn thing would collapse under him as it groaned. Thunder cracked overhead, and all eyes shifted to the bay of windows overlooking the quay. Rain fell in earnest, setting the barges bobbing and swaying. Lunch was dropped before them, the bowls clattering and sending the goopy brown stew splashing over the chipped rims. Aelin didn't so much as look at it, or touch the ales that were plunked down with equal disinterest for a tip as she scanned the room.
Drink, Aelin commanded him.
Lorcan debated telling her not to give him orders, but he liked seeing this small, fine-boned creature in action. Liked seeing her size up a room of strangers and select her prey. Because it was a hunt, for the best and safest source of information. The person who wouldn't report to a town garrison still under Otterland's control that a dark-haired young woman was asking questions about enemy forces. So Lorcan drank, and watched her while she watched others.
So many calculating thoughts beneath that pale face.
So many lies ready to spill from those rosebud lips. Part of him wondered if his own queen could find her useful, if Maeve would also pick up on the fact that it was perhaps Aneth herself who'd taught the girl to look and listen and lie. Part of him dreaded the thought of Aelin in Maeve's hands, what she'd become, what Maeve would ask her to do as a spy or courtier. Perhaps it was good that Aelin was mortal. Lifespan too short for Maeve to bother honing her into quite possibly her most vicious sentinel. He was so damn busy thinking about it that he nearly didn't notice when Aelin leaned back casually in her chair and interrupted the table of merchants and captains behind them.
What do you mean Rifthold is gone?
Lorcan snapped to attention. But they'd heard the news weeks ago. The captain nearest them, a woman in her early 30s, sized up Aelin, then Lorcan, then said,
Well, it's not gone, but witches now control it, on behalf of Duke Parrington.
Dorian Havilliard's been ousted. Aelin, the cunning little liar, looked outright shocked.
We've been in the deep wild for weeks. Is Dorian Havilliard dead?
She whispered the words, as if in horror, and as if to avoid being heard. Another person at the table, an older bearded man, said,
They never found his body, but if the Duke's declaring him not to be king anymore, I'd assume he's alive. No use making proclamations against a dead man.
Thunder rattled, almost drowning out her whisper as she said,
Would he go to the north? To her?
They knew precisely who Aelin meant. and Lorcan knew exactly why she'd come here.
She was going to leave. Tomorrow, whenever the carnival rolled out.
She'd likely hire one of these boats to take her northward. And he would go south. To Morath. The companions swapped glances, weighing the appearance of the young woman, and then Lorcan. He attempted to smile, to look bland and unthreatening. None of them returned the look, though he must have done something right, because the bearded man said,
"She's not in the north."
It was Elide's turn to go still. The bearded man went on.
"Rumor has it she was in Ilium, trouncing soldiers. Then they say she was in Skull's Bay last week, raising hell. Now she's sailing elsewhere. Some say to Wendland, some say to Eelway. Some say she's fleeing to the other side of the world. But she's not in the north. Won't be for a while, it seems. Not wise to leave your home undefended, if you ask me. But she's barely a woman. She can't know much about warfare at all."
Lorcan doubted that, and doubted the bitch didn't make a move without Whitethorn or Gavriel's son weighing in. But Elide loosed a shuddering breath.
"Why leave Terrasen at all?"
"Who knows?"
The woman turned back to her food and company. "Seems like the queen has a habit of showing up where she's least expected, unleashing chaos and vanishing again. There's good money to be had from the betting pool about where she'll show up next. I say Benjali, in Eelway. Vras here says Varez in Wendlin."
"Why Eelway?"
Elide pushed.
"Who knows? She'd be a fool indeed to announce her plans."
The woman gave Elide a sharp look, as if to say keep quiet about it. Elide returned to her food and ale, the rain and thunder drowning the chatter in the room. Lorcan watched her drink the entire tankard in silence, and when it seemed the least suspicious, she rose and left. Elide went to two other taverns in the town, followed the same exact pattern. The news shifted slightly with each recounting, but the general consensus was that Aelin was on the move, perhaps south or east, and no one knew what to expect. Elide walked out of the third tavern, Lorcan on her heels. They hadn't spoken once since she'd gone into that first inn. He'd been too lost in contemplating what it would be like to suddenly travel on his own again. To leave her, and never see her again. And now, staring up at the rain and the thunder, Elide said,
"I was supposed to go north."
Lorcan found himself not wanting to confirm or object. Like a useless fool, he found himself hesitating to push her toward that original path. She lowered her face, water and light gilding her high cheekbones.
"Where do I head now? How do I find her?"
He dared say,
"What did you glean from the rumors?"
He'd been analyzing each tidbit of information, but wanted to see that clever mind at work. And some small part of him wanted to see what she'd decide about their splitting ways, too. Elide said softly,
"Benjali. In Eelway. I think she's going to Benjali."
He tried not to look too relieved. He'd arrived at the same conclusion, if only because it was what Whitethorn would have done, and he'd trained the prince himself for a few decades. She scrubbed at her face.
How far is it?"
"Far."
She lowered her hands, her features stark and bone white.
"How do I get there?
She rubbed at her chest.
"I can get you a map,"
he found himself saying, just to see if she'd ask him to stay. Her throat bobbed, and she shook her head, her black hair flowing.
It'd be no use.
Maps are always useful.
Not if you can't read.
Lorcan blinked, wondering if he'd heard her right. But color stained her pale cheeks, and that was indeed shame and despair clouding her dark eyes.
But you...
There had been no opportunity for it these weeks, he realized. No chance where she might have revealed it.
I learned my letters, but when everything happened, she said, and I was put in that tower. My nursemaid was illiterate, so I never learned more. So I forgot what I did know. He wondered if he would have ever noticed if she hadn't told him.
You seem to have survived rather impressively without it.
He spoke without considering, but it seemed to be the right thing to say.
The corners of her mouth twitched upward.
I suppose I have,
she mused. Lorcan's magic picked up on the garrison before he heard or scented them. It slithered along their swords, rudimentary, half-rusted weapons, and then bathed in their rising fear, excitement, perhaps even a tinge of bloodlust. Not good. Not when they were headed right to them.
Lorcan closed the distance to Elide. It seems our friends at the carnival wanted to make an easy silver coin.
The helpless desperation on her face sharpened into wide-eyed alertness.
Guards are coming?
Lorcan nodded. The footsteps now close enough for him to count how many approached from the garrison in the heart of the town, no doubt meant to trap them between their swords and the river. If he were the betting sort, he'd gamble that the two bridges that spanned the river, 10 blocks up on either side of them, were already full of guards.
You get a choice,
he said.
Either I can end this matter here, and we can go back to the inn to learn if Nick and Ombriel wanted to get rid of us.
Her mouth tightened, and he knew her choice before he offered.
Or we can get on one of those barges and get the hell out right now.
The second,
she breathed.
Good,
was his only reply, as he gripped her hand and tugged her forward. Even with his power supporting her leg, she was too slow.
Just do it, she snapped.
So Lorcan hauled her over a shoulder, freeing his hatchet with his other hand, and ran for the water. Elide bounced and slammed into Lorcan's broad shoulder, craning her head enough to watch the street behind them. No sign of guards, but that little voice who often whispered in her ear now tugged and begged her to go, to get out.
The gate's at the city entrance,
she gasped, as muscle and bone pummeled into her gut.
They'll be there too.
Leave them to me.
Elide tried not to imagine what that meant, but then they were at the docks, Lorcan sprinting for a barge, thundering down the steps of the quay and onto the long wooden dock. The barge was smaller than the others, its one-room chamber in the center painted bright green. Empty, aside from a few boxes of cargo on its prow. Lorcan pocketed the axe he'd thumbed free, and Elide gripped his shoulder, fingers digging into muscle, as he set her over the high lip of the barge and onto the wooden planks. She stumbled a step as her legs adjusted to the bobbing of the river, but Lorcan was already whirling toward the reed-slim man who barreled toward them, a knife out.
That's my boat, he bleated.
He realized who exactly he would be fighting as he cleared the short wooden ladder onto the dock and took in Lorcan's size, the hatchet and sword now in the warrior's broad hands, and the expression of death surely on his face. Lorcan said simply,
It's our boat now.
The man glanced between them.
You won't clear the bridges or the city walls.
Moments. They had only moments before the guards came. Lorcan said to the man,
"Get in. Now."
The man began backing away. Elide braced her hand on the broad, raised side of the boat and said calmly,
"He will kill you before you clear the ladder. Get us out of the city, and I swear you'll be set free once we're clear."
"You'll slit my throat, then, as good as you will now,"
the man said, gulping in air.
Indeed, Lorcan's hatchet bobbed in that way she'd learned meant he was about to throw it.
"I would ask you to reconsider," Elide said.
Lorcan's wrist twitched ever so slightly. He'd do it. He'd kill this innocent man just to get them free. The man's knife drooped, then vanished into the sheath at his side.
"There's a bend in the river past the town. Drop me off there."
That was all Elide needed to hear, as the man rushed toward them, untying lines and leaping into the boat with the ease of someone who'd done it 1,000 times. He and Lorcan grabbed the poles to push out into the river, and as soon as they were loose, Lorcan hissed,
"If you betray us, you'll be dead before the guards can even board."
The man nodded, now steering them toward the eastern exit of the town, as Lorcan dragged her into the one-room cabin. The cabin interior was lined with windows, all clean enough to suggest the man took some pride in his boat. Lorcan half-shoved her under a table in its center, the embroidered cloth covering it, shielding her from anything but sounds. Lorcan's footsteps going silent, though she could feel him taking up a hiding place to monitor the proceedings from within the cabin. The patter of rain on the flat roof, the thud of the pole, as it occasionally knocked into the side of the barge. Her body soon ached from holding herself still and quiet. Was this to be her life for the foreseeable future? Hunted and hounded across the world? And finding Aelin, how would she ever do that? She could go back to Terrasen, but she didn't know who ruled from Orinth. If Aelin had not taken back her throne, perhaps it was an unspoken message that danger lay there, that all was not well in Terrasen. But to go to Ealhwaay on a bit of speculation? Of all the rumors Elide had listened to in the past 2 hours, that captain's reasons had been the wisest. The world seemed to still with some unspoken tension, a ripple of fear. But then the man's voice was calling out again, and metal groaned. A gate. The city gates. She stayed under the table, counting her breaths, thinking through all that she'd heard. She doubted the carnival would miss them. And she'd bet all the money in her boot that Nick and Ombriel had been the ones who'd set the guards on them, deciding she and Lorcan were too much of a threat, especially with the Ilken hunting her. She wondered if Molly had known all along, from that very first meeting, that they were liars, and had let Nick and Ombriel sell them out when the bounty was too good to pass up, the cost of loyalty too great. Elide sighed through her nose. A splash sounded, but the boat ambled onward. At least she'd taken the little bit of stone with her, though she'd miss her clothes, shabby as they were. These leathers were growing stuffy in the oppressive heat, and if she were to go to Ealhwaay, they'd be sweltering. Lorcan's footsteps sounded.
"Get out."
Wincing as her ankle barked in pain, she crawled from under the table and peered around.
"No trouble?"
He shook his head. He was splattered with rain or river water. She peered around him to where the man had been steering the boat. No one there. Or in the rear of the boat.
"He swam to shore back at the bend,"
Lorcan explained.
Elide loosed a breath.
"He might very well run to town and tell them. It won't take long for them to catch up."
"We'll deal with it,"
Lorcan said, turning away.
"Too fast."
He avoided her eyes too fast. She took in the water, the stains now on the sleeves of his shirt. Like,
like he'd washed his hands quickly, sloppily. She glanced at the hatchet at his side as he strode out of the cabin.
You killed him, didn't you?
That was what the splash had been, a body being dumped over the side. Lorcan halted, looked over a broad shoulder. There was nothing human in his dark eyes.
If you want to survive, you have to be willing to do what is necessary.
He might have had a family depending on him.
She'd seen no wedding ring, but it didn't mean anything.
Nick and Ombriel didn't give us that consideration when they reported us to the garrison.
He stalked onto the deck, and she stormed after him. Lush trees lined the river, a living shield around them. And there was a stain on the planks, shining and dark. Her stomach rose.
You planned to lie to me about it,
she seethed.
But how would you explain that?
A shrug. Lorcan took up the pole and moved with fluid grace to the side of the barge, where he pushed them away from an approaching sandbank.
He had killed that man. I swore to him he'd be set free.
You swore it, not me.
Her fingers curled into fists. And that thing, that stone wrapped in that bit of cloth inside her jacket, began to stir. Lorcan stilled, the pole gripped tight in his hands.
What is that?
He said too softly. She held her ground. Like hell she'd back down from him. Like hell she'd allow him to intimidate her. Overrule her, kill people so they could escape.
What is that?
She refused to speak, to even touch the lump in her pocket. It thrummed and grumbled, a beast opening an eye. But she didn't dare to reach out, to so much as acknowledge that strange otherworldly presence. Lorcan's eyes widened slightly. Then he was setting down the pole and stalking across the deck and into the cabin. She lingered by the edge, unsure whether to follow, or perhaps jump into the water and swim to shore, but there was a thud of metal on metal, as if something was being cracked open, and then Lorcan's roar shook the boat, the river, the trees. Long-legged river birds hauled themselves into flight. Then Lorcan flung open the door, so violently it nearly ripped off its hinges, and hurled what looked to be the shards of a broken amulet into the river. Or he tried to. Lorcan threw it hard enough that it cleared the river entirely and slammed into a tree, gouging out a chunk of wood. He whirled, and Elide's anger stumbled a step at the blistering wrath twisting his features. He prowled for her, grabbing the pole as if to keep from throttling her, and said,
"What is it that you carry?"
And the demand, the violence and entitlement and arrogance, had her seeing red too. So Elide said with quiet venom,
"Why don't you just slit my throat and find out for yourself?"
Lorcan's nostrils flared. If you have a problem with my killing someone who reeked of itching to betray us the moment he got the chance, then you are going to love your queen. For a while now, he'd hinted that he knew of her. That he knew of her well enough to call her horrible things, but
what do you mean?
Lorcan, gods above, looked as if his temper had at last slipped its leash, as he said.
Selena Sardothian is a 19-year-old assassin who calls herself the best in the world.
A snort.
She killed and reveled and shopped her way through life and never once apologized for it. She gloried in it. And then this spring, one of my sentinels, Prince Rowan Whitethorn, was tasked to deal with her when she washed up on Wendland's shores.
Turns out he fell in love with her instead, and she with him. Turns out, whatever they were doing up in the Cambrian Mountains got her to stop calling herself Selena and start going by her true name again. A brutal smile. Aelin Galathinius. Elide could barely feel her body.
What?
Was about the only word she could manage. Your fire-breathing queen? She's a god's damned assassin. Trained to be a killer from the moment your mother died defending her. Trained to be no better than the man who butchered your mother and your royal family. Elide shook her head, her hands slackening.
What?
She said again. Lorkin laughed mirthlessly. While you were locked in that tower for 10 years, she was indulging in the riches of Rifthold, spoiled and coddled by her master, the King of the Assassins, whom she murdered in cold blood this spring. So you'll find that your long-lost savior is little better than I am. You'll find that she would have killed that man the same as I did, and would have as little tolerance for your whining as I do.
Aelin. An assassin. Aelin, the same person she'd been tasked to give the stone to. You knew,
she said.
This whole time we've been together, you knew I was looking for the same person.
I told you that to find one would be to find the other.
You knew and you didn't tell me. Why?
You still haven't told me your secrets. I don't see why I should tell all of mine either.
She squeezed her eyes shut, trying to ignore the dark stain on the wood, trying to soothe the sting of his words and seal the hole that had opened beneath her feet. What had been in that amulet? Why had he roared and...
Your little queen, Lorkin sneered, is a murderer and a thief. And a liar. So if you're going to call me such things, then be prepared to fling them at her, too.
Her skin was too tight, her bones too brittle to bear the anger that took control. She scrambled for the right words to hurt him, wound him, as if they were fistfuls of rocks that she could hurl at Lorkin's head. Elide hissed. I was wrong. I said you and I were the same, that we had no family, no friends. But I have none because land and circumstance separate me from them. You have none because no one can stomach being around you. She tried, and succeeded, if the ire that rippled in his eyes was any indication, to look down her nose at him, even with him towering over her. And you know what is the biggest lie you tell everyone, Lorkin? It's that you prefer it that way. But what I hear, when you rant about my bitch queen, all I hear are the words of someone who is deeply, deeply jealous and lonely and pathetic. All I hear are the words of someone who saw Aelin and Prince Rowan fall in love and resented them for their happiness, because you are so unhappy.
She couldn't stop the words once they started flinging out.
So call Aelin a murderer and a thief and a liar. Call her a bitch queen and a fire breather. But forgive me if I take it upon myself to be the judge of those things when I meet her, which I will do.
She pointed to the muddy gray river flowing around them.
I'm going to Eelwe. Take me ashore, and I'll wash my hands of you as easily as you washed the blood of that man off yours.
Lorkin looked her over, teeth bared enough to show those slightly elongated canines. But she didn't care about his fey heritage, or his age, or his ability to kill. After a moment, he went back to pushing the pole against the river bottom. Not to bring them to shore, but to guide them along.
Did you not hear what I said? Take me to shore.
No.
Her rage overcame any sort of common sense, any warning from Aneth as she stormed over to him.
No!
He let the pole drag in the water and turned his face to her. No emotion. Not even anger lingered there.
The river veered southward 2 miles ago. From the map in the cabin, we can take it straight south, then find the fastest route to Banjali.
She wiped the rain from her dripping brow, as Lorcan brought his face close enough for them to share breath.
Turns out, I now have business with Aelin Galathinius, too. Congratulations, lady. You just got yourself a guide to Eelway.
A cold, killing light was in his eyes, and she wondered what the hell he'd roared about. But those eyes dipped to her mouth, clamped tight in her rage. And a part of her that had nothing to do with fear went still at the attention, even as other parts went a bit molten. Lorcan's eyes at last found her own, and his voice was a midnight growl as he said,
"As far as anyone's concerned, you're still my wife."
Elide didn't object. Even as she walked back into the cabin, his insufferable magic helping with her limp, and slammed the door shut so hard the glass rattled. Storm clouds drifted away, to reveal a star-flecked night and a moon bright enough for Lorcan to navigate the narrow, sleepy river. He steered them hour after hour, contemplating precisely how he was going to murder Aelin Galathinius, without Elide or Whitethorn getting in the way, and then how he was going to slice up her corpse and feed it to the crows. She had lied to him. She and Whitethorn had tricked him that day the prince had handed over the word key. There'd been nothing inside the amulet but one of those rings, an utterly useless wordstone ring wrapped in a bit of parchment. And on it was written in a feminine scrawl, "Here's hoping you discover more creative terms than bitch to call me when you find this. With all my love, AAG. He'd kill her. Slowly, creatively. He'd been forced to swear a blood promise that Mala's ring truly offered him immunity from the Vogue when it was worn. He hadn't thought to demand that their word key was real, too. And Elide. What Elide carried. What had made him realize it. He'd think about that later. Contemplate what to do with the Lady of Peranth later. His only consolation was that he'd stolen Mala's ring back. But the little bitch still had the key. And if Elide needed to go to Aelin anyway, oh, he'd find Aelin for Elide. And he'd make the Queen of Terrasen crawl before the end of it. Chapter 44. The world began and ended in fire. A sea of fire with no room for air, for sound beyond the cascading molten earth. The true heart of fire, the tool of creation and destruction. And she was drowning in it. Its weight smothered her as she thrashed, seeking a surface or a bottom to push off from. Neither existed. As it flooded her throat, surging into her body and melting her apart, she began screaming noiselessly, begging it to halt.
Aelin.
The name, roared into the core of flame at the heart of the world, was a beacon, a summons. She'd been born waiting to hear that voice, had blindly sought it her whole life, would follow it unto the ending of all things.
Aelin!
Aelin bowed off the bed, flame in her mouth, her throat, her eyes. Real flame. Golds and blues wove among simmering swaths of red. Real flame, erupting from her, the sheet scorched, the room and the rest of the bed spared from incineration, the ship in the middle of the sea spared from incineration, by an uncompromising, unbreakable wall of air. Hands wrapped in ice squeezed her shoulders, and through the flame, Rowan's snarling face appeared, commanding her to breathe. She took a breath. More flame rushed down her throat. There was no tether, no leash to bring her magic to heal. Oh gods, she couldn't even feel a burnout threatening nearby. There was nothing but this flame. Rowan gripped her face in his hands, steam rippling where his ice and wind met her fire.
You are its master. You control it. Your fear grants it the right to take over.
Her body arced off the mattress again, utterly naked. She must have burned her clothes, Rowan's favorite shirt. Her flames burned wilder. He gripped her hard, forcing her to meet his eyes as he snarled,
I see you. I see every part of you, and I am not afraid.
I will not be afraid.
A line in the burning brightness.
My name is Aelin Ashriver Galathinius, and I will not be afraid.
As surely as if she grabbed it in her hand, the leash appeared. Darkness flowed in, blessed and calm where that burning pit of flame had raged. She swallowed once, twice.
Rowan.
His eyes gleamed with near animal brightness, scanning every inch of her. His heartbeat was rampant, thundering, panicked.
Rowan,
she repeated. Still, he did not move, did not stop staring at her, searching for signs of harm. Something in her own chest shifted at his panic. Aelin grasped his shoulder, digging in her nails at the violence rampant on every line of his body, as if he'd loosed whatever leashes he kept on himself, in anticipation of fighting to keep her in this body, and not some goddess, or worse.
Calm down.
Now. He did no such thing. Rolling her eyes, she tugged his hands from her face to lean over and throw the sheets off them. I am fine, she said, enunciating each word.
You saw to that.
Now get me some water. I'm thirsty. A basic, easy command. To serve, in the way he'd explained that fey males liked to be needed, to fulfill some part of them that wanted to fuss and dote, to drag him back up to that level of civilization and reason. Rowan's face was still harsh with feral wrath, and the insidious terror running beneath it. So Aelin leaned in, nipped his jaw, making sure her canines scratched, and said onto his skin,
If you don't start acting like a prince, you can sleep on the floor.
Rowan pulled back, his savage face not wholly of this world. But slowly, as if the words sank in, his features softened. He was still looking pissy, but not so near killing that invisible threat against her, as he leaned in, nipping her jaw in return, and said into her ear,
I'm going to make you regret using such threats, princess.
Oh gods, her toes curled, but she gave him a simpering smile as he rose to his feet, every muscle in his naked body rippling with the movement, and watched him pad with feline grace to the washstand and ewer atop it. The bastard had the nerve to look her over as he lifted the jug, and then give her a satisfied male smile as he poured a glass right to the brim, halting with expert precision. She debated sending a lick of flame to burn his bare ass as he set down the jug with emphasized care and calm, and then stalked back to the bed, eyes on her every step of the way, and set the water on the small table beside it. Aelin rose on surprisingly steady knees, and faced him. Only the creaking of the ship and hissing of the waves against it filled the room.
What was that?
She asked quietly. His eyes shuddered.
It was me losing control.
Why?
He glanced at the porthole and moon-kissed sea beyond. So rare for him to avoid her stare. Why? She pushed. Rowan at last met her gaze.
I didn't know if she'd taken you again.
No matter that the word key now lay beside the bed and not around her neck.
Even when I realized you were just in the magic's thrall, I still... The magic took you away. It's been a long time since I wasn't certain. Since I didn't know how to get you back.
He bared his teeth, loosing a jagged breath, the wrath now directed inward.
Before you call me a territorial fey bastard, allow me to apologize and explain that it is very difficult.
Rowan.
He stilled. She crossed the small lingering distance between them, every step like the answer to some question she'd asked from the moment her soul had sparked into existence.
You are not human. I do not expect you to be.
He almost seemed to recoil, but she put a hand on his bare chest, over his heart. It still thundered beneath her palm. She said softly, feeling that heart beneath her hand.
I do not care if you are fey or human,
if you are Vog or a goddamned skinwalker.
You are what you are. And what I want, what I need, Rowan, is someone who does not apologize for it,
for who they are. You have never once done so. She leaned forward to kiss the bare skin where her hand had been.
Please don't start doing it now.
Yes, sometimes you piss me the hell off with that fey territorial nonsense, but...
I heard your voice.
It woke me up.
It led me out of that... place.
He bowed his head until his brow leaned against hers.
I wish I had more to offer you. During this war, and beyond it.
She slid her arms around his bare waist.
You offer me more than I ever hoped for.
He seemed to object, but she said,
And I figured, since both Darrow and Rolf informed me I needed to sell my hand in marriage for the sake of this war, I should do the opposite. A snort.
Typical. But if Terrison needs...
Here's the way I see it, she said, pulling back to examine his harsh face. We do not have the luxury of time, and a marriage to a foreign kingdom, with its contracts and distances, plus the months it takes to raise and send an army, we do not have that time. We only have now. And what I don't need is a husband who will try to get into a pissing contest with me, or who I'll have to cloister somewhere for his own safety, or who will hide in a corner when I wake up with flames all around me. She kissed his tattooed chest again, right over that mighty, thundering heart. This, Rowan, this is all I need. Just this.
The reverberations of his deep, rattling breath echoed into her cheek, and he stroked a hand over her hair, along her bare back, lower.
A court that can change the world.
She kissed the corner of his mouth.
We'll find a way. Together.
The words he'd given her once, the words that had begun the healing of her shattered heart, and his own.
Did I hurt?
Her words were a rasp.
No.
He brushed a thumb over his cheekbone.
No, you didn't hurt me. Or anything else.
Something in her chest caved in, and Rowan gathered her in his arms as she buried her face in his neck. His calloused hands caressed her back, over each and every scar and the tattoos he'd inked on her.
If we survive this war,
she murmured after a while, onto his bare chest.
You and I are going to have to learn how to relax, to sleep through the night.
If we survive this war, princess,
he said, running a finger down the groove of her spine.
I'll be happy to do anything you want, even learn how to relax.
And if we never have a moment's peace, even after we get the lock, the keys, and send Erewhon back to his hellhole realm? The amusement faded, replaced by something more intent, as his fingers stilled on her back.
Even if we have threats of war every other day,
even if we have to host fussy emissaries, even if we have to visit god-awful kingdoms and play nice,
I'll be happy to do it, if you're at my side.
Her lips trembled. Ugh, you. Since when did you learn to make such pretty speeches?
I just needed the right excuse to learn,
he said, kissing her cheek. Her body went taut and molten in all the right places as his mouth moved lower, pressing gentle, biting kisses to her jaw, her ear, her neck. She dug her fingers into his back, baring her throat as his canines scratched lightly.
I love you.
Rowan breathed onto her skin and flicked his tongue over the spot where his canines had scratched.
I'd walk into the burning heart of hell itself to find you.
He almost had mere minutes ago, she wanted to say. But Aelin only arched her back a bit more, a small, needy noise coming out of her. This? Him? Would it ever stop? The wanting? The need to not only be near him, but to have him so deep in her she felt their souls twining. Their magic dancing. The tether that had led her out of that burning core of madness and destruction.
Please,
she breathed, nails digging into his lower back in emphasis. Rowan's low groan was his only answer as he hoisted her up. She wrapped her legs around his waist, letting him carry her not to the bed, but to the wall. And the sensation of the cool wood against her back, compared to the heat and hardness of him pushing into her front. Aelin panted through her gritted teeth as he again dragged his tongue over that spot on her neck.
Please.
She felt his smile against her skin, as Rowan thrust into her in a long, powerful stroke, and bit down on her neck. Acclaiming, mighty and true, that she understood he so desperately needed, that she needed. And with his teeth in her, his body in her, she was going to combust. She was going to splinter apart from the overwhelming need. Rowan's hips began to move, setting a lazy, smooth pace as he kept his canines buried in her neck. As his tongue slid along the twin points of pleasure edged with finest pain, as he tasted her very essence, as if it were wine. He laughed, low and wicked, as Release had her biting down on his shoulder to keep from screaming loud enough to wake the creatures sleeping on the bottom of the sea. When Rowan finally drew his mouth away from her neck, his magic healing the small holes he'd left, his hands tightened on her thighs, pinning her to the wall as he moved deeper, harder. Aelin only dragged her fingers through his hair as she gave him a savage kiss and tasted her own blood on his tongue. She whispered onto his mouth,
I'll always find a way back to you.
This time, when Aelin went over the edge, Rowan plummeted with her. Manon Blackbeak awoke. There had been no sound, no smell, no hint of why she'd awoken. But those predatory instincts had sensed something amiss and sent her tumbling from sleep. She blinked as she sat up, her wound now a dull ache, and found her head clear of whatever that haze had been. The room was near black, save for the moonlight that trickled through the porthole to illuminate her cramped cabin. How long had she been lost to sleep in hideous melancholy? She listened carefully to the creaking of the ship. A faint grumbling sounded from above. Abraxos, still alive. Still sleeping, if she knew that drowsy, wheezing grumble. She tested the manacles on her wrists, lifting them to peer at the lock. A clever sort of contraption, the chains thick and anchored soundly into the wall. Her ankles were no better. She couldn't remember the last time she'd been in chains. How had Elite endured it for a decade? Maybe she'd find the girl once she got out of here. She doubted the Havilyard King had any news of the 13 anyway. She'd sneak onto Abraxos' back, fly for the coast, and find Elite before tracking down her coven. And then, she didn't know what she'd do. But it was better than lying here like a worm in the sun, letting whatever despair had seized control these days or weeks wreak havoc on her. But as if she'd summoned him, the door opened. Dorian stood there, a candle in his... not a candle. Pure flame wreathed his fingers. It set his sapphire eyes glowing bright as he found her lucid.
Was it you who sent that ripple of power?
No, though it didn't take much guessing to suspect who it had been then. Witches don't have magic like that. He angled his head, his blue-black hair stained gold by his flames.
But you're long-lived.
She nodded, and he took that as an invitation to slide into his usual chair. It's called the Yielding, she said, a chill brushing down her spine. The bit of magic we have. We usually cannot summon or wield, but for one moment in a witch's life, she can summon great power to unleash upon her enemies. The cost is that she is incinerated in the blast, her body yielded to the darkness. In the witch wars, witches on both sides made yieldings during every battle and skirmish.
It's suicide, to blow yourself into smithereens and take enemies with you.
It is, and it's not pretty. As the Iron Teeth Witch yields life to the darkness, its power fills her and unleashes from her in an ebony wave, a manifestation of what lies in our souls.
Have you seen it done?
Once. By a scared young witch who knew she wouldn't win glory any other way. Only she took out half our Iron Teeth force as well as the Crokins. Her mind snagged on the word. Crokins. Her people. Not her people. She was a goddamned blackbeak.
Will the Iron Teeth use it on us?
If you're facing lower-level covens, yes. Older covens are too arrogant, too skilled to choose the Yielding instead of fighting their way out. But younger, weaker covens get spooked, or wish to win valor through sacrifice.
It's murder.
It's war. War is sanctioned murder, no matter what side you're on. Ire flickered on his face, and she asked, Have you ever killed a man? He opened his mouth to say no, but the light in his hand died. He had, when he'd been collared, she guessed. The Volg inside him had done it, multiple times, and not cleanly. Remember what they made you do, Manon said, when you face them again.
I doubt I'll ever forget it, witchling.
He stood, heading for the door. Manon said, These chains are rubbing my skin raw. Surely you've some sympathy for chained things. Dorian paused. She lifted her hands, displaying the chains. I'll give my word not to do any harm.
It's not my call.
Now that you're talking again, maybe telling Aelin what she's been pushing you about will get you on her good side. Manon had no idea what the queen had been demanding of her. None. The longer I stay in here, princeling, the more likely I am to do something stupid when you release me. Let me at least feel the wind on my face.
You've got a window. Go stand in front of it.
Part of her sat up straight at the harshness, the maleness in that tone, in the set of those broad shoulders. She purred. If I had been asleep, would you have lingered to stare at me for a while? Icy amusement gleamed there.
Would you have objected?
And perhaps she was reckless and wild and still a bit stupid from blood loss. But she said, if you plan to sneak in here in the darkest hours of the night, you should at least have the decency to ensure I get something out of it. His lips twitched, though the smile was cold and sensuous, in a way that made her wonder what playing with a king blessed with raw magic might be like. If he'd make her beg for the first time in her long life. He looked capable of it, perhaps willing to let a little cruelty into the bedroom. Her blood thrummed.
As tempting as seeing you naked and chained might be.
A soft lover's laugh. I don't think you'd enjoy the loss of control. And you've been with so many women to be able to judge a witch's wants so easily. That smile turned lazy.
A gentleman never tells.
How many? He was only 20, though he was a prince, now a king. Women had likely been falling over themselves for him since his voice had deepened.
How many men have you been with?
He countered. She smirked. Enough to know how to handle the needs of mortal princelings, to know what will make you beg. Never mind that she was contemplating the opposite. He drifted across the room, past the range of her chains, right into her own breathing space. He leaned over her, nearly nose to nose, nothing at all amused in his face, in the cut of his cruel, beautiful mouth, as he said,
I don't think you can handle the sort of things I need, witchling. And I am never begging for anything again in my life.
And then he left. Manon stared after him, a hiss of rage slipping from her own lips. At the opportunity she hadn't taken to grab him, hold him hostage, and demand her freedom. At the arrogance in his assumption. At the heat that had gathered in her core and now throbbed insistently enough that she clamped her legs together. She had never been denied. Men had fallen to pieces, sometimes literally, to crawl into her bed. And she didn't know what she would have done if he had taken up her offer. If she would have decided to learn what the king could do exactly with that beautiful mouth and toned body. A distraction. And an excuse to loathe herself even more, she supposed. She was still seething at the door when it opened again. Dorian leaned against the aged wood, his eyes still glazed in a way she couldn't tell was lust or hatred or both. He slid the lock shut without looking at it. Her heartbeat picked up. Her entire immortal focus narrowed to his steady, unhurried breathing, the unreadable face. His voice was rough as he said,
I won't waste my breath telling you how stupid it would be to try to take me hostage.
I won't waste mine telling you to take only what I offer you and nothing more.
Her ears strained to listen, but even his damned heart was a solid beat. Not a whiff of fear. He said,
I need to hear you say yes.
His eyes flicked to the chains. It took her a moment to comprehend, but she let out a low laugh.
So considerate, princeling. But yes, I do this of my own free will. It can be our little secret.
She was nothing and no one now anyway. Sharing a bed with her enemy was nothing compared to the Kraken blood that flowed in her veins. She began to unbutton the white shirt she'd been wearing for gods knew how long. But he growled,
I'll do it myself.
Like hell he would. She touched the second button. Invisible hands wrapped around her wrists, tightly enough that she dropped the shirt. Dorian prowled to her.
I said that I'd do it.
Manon took in each inch of him as he towered over her, and a shiver of pleasure rippled through her.
I suggest you listen.
The pure male arrogance in that statement alone.
You're courting death if you...
Dorian lowered his mouth to hers. It was a feather-light graze, barely a whisper of touch. Intent, calculated, and so unexpected she arched into it a bit. He kissed the corner of her mouth with the same silken gentleness, then the other corner. She didn't move, didn't even breathe, like every part of her body was waiting to see what he'd do next. But Dorian pulled back, studying her eyes with a cool detachment. Whatever he beheld there made him step away. The invisible fingers on her wrists vanished. The door unlatched, and that cocky grin returned as Dorian shrugged with one shoulder and said,
Maybe another night, witchling.
Manon almost bellowed as he slipped out the door, and didn't return. Chapter 45. The witch was lucid, but pissed off. Adian had the pleasure of serving her breakfast, and tried not to note the lingering scent of female arousal in the cabin, or that Dorian's scent was entwined among it. The king was entitled to move on, Adian reminded himself hours later, as he scanned the late afternoon horizon from the ship's helm. In the quiet hours of his watches, he'd often mulled over the thorough scolding Lysander had given him regarding his anger and cruelty toward the king. And maybe, just maybe, Lysander was right. And maybe the fact that Dorian could even look at a female with interest after seeing Sorsha beheaded was a miracle. But the witch? That was what he wanted to tangle with? He asked Lysandra as much when she joined him 30 minutes later, still soaked from patrolling the waters ahead. All clear. Lysandra finger-combed her inky sheet of hair, frowning. I had clients who lost their wives or lovers and wanted something to distract them. Wanted the opposite of who their beloved had been. Perhaps to make the act feel wholly separate. What he went through would change anyone. He might very well find himself now attracted to dangerous things.
He already had a penchant for them, Adian murmured, glancing to where Aelin and Rowan sparred on the main deck, sweat gleaming golden as the afternoon light shifted toward evening.
Dorian perched on the nearby steps up to the quarter deck, Damaris braced over his knees, half awake in the heat. Part of Adian smiled, knowing Rowan would no doubt kick his ass for it.
Aelin was dangerous, but still human, Lysandra observed. Manon is not. He probably likes it that way, and I'd stay out of it if I were you.
I'm not getting in the middle of that disaster, don't worry. Though I wouldn't let those iron teeth near my favorite part if I were him.
Adian grinned, as Lysandra tipped her head back and laughed. He added,
Besides, watching Aelin and the witch go head-to-head this morning about Elide was enough to remind me to stay the hell back and enjoy the spectacle.
Little Elide Locken, alive and out there searching for them. Gods above.
The look on Aelin's face when Manon had revealed detail after detail, what Vernon had tried to do to the girl.
There would be a reckoning in Peranth for that. Adian himself would hang the Lord by his intestines while Vernon was still breathing. And then he'd get started on paying Vernon back for the 10 years of horror Elide had endured, for the maimed foot and the chains, for the tower. Locked in a tower. In a city he'd visited so many times in the past 10 years, he had no count. She might have even watched the Bane from that spire as they came and left the city, possibly thinking he'd forgotten or didn't care about her either. And now she was out there, alone, with a permanently mangled foot, no training and no weapons. If she was lucky, perhaps she'd run into the Bane first. His commanders would recognize her name, protect her. That is, if she dared to reveal herself at all. It had taken all his self-control not to strangle Manon for abandoning the girl in the middle of Oakwald, for not flying her right to Terrasen. Aelin, however, hadn't bothered with restraint. 2 strikes, both so fast even the wing leader didn't see them. A backhanded blow to Manon's face for leaving Elide, and then a ring of fire around Manon's throat, slamming her into the wood, as Aelin made her swear the information was correct. Rowan had dryly reminded Aelin that Manon was responsible for Elide's escape and rescue, too. Aelin had merely said if Manon hadn't been, the fire would already be down her throat. And that was that. Aelin, from the fervor with which she sparred with Rowan across the deck, was still pissed. The witch, from the snarling and scent in her cabin, was still pissed. Adian was more than ready to get to the Stone Marshes, even if what awaited them there might not be so pleasant. 3 more days lay between them and the eastern coast, and then they'd all see how much Rolf's alliance was worth, if the man could be trusted. You can't avoid him forever, you know, Lysandra said,
drawing his attention to the other reason he needed to get off this ship. His father sat near where Abraxos had curled along the prow, guarding and observing the Wyvern, learning how to kill them, where to strike. No matter that the Wyvern was little more than an oversized hound, docile enough that they hadn't bothered to chain him. They'd had none big enough anyway, and the beast would likely refuse to leave this ship until Manon did. Abraxos only moved to hunt for fish or larger game, Lysandra escorting him in sea dragon form beneath the waves. And when the beast was sprawled on the deck, the lion kept him company. Adian had barely spoken to Gavriel since Skull's Bay.
I'm not avoiding him, Adian said.
I just have no interest in talking to him. Lysandra flipped her wet hair over a shoulder, frowning at the damp splotches on her white shirt.
I, for one, would like to hear the story of how he crossed paths with your mother. He's kind, for one of Maeve's cadre. Better than Fenris.
Indeed, Fenris made Adian want to shatter things. That laughing face, the swaggering dark arrogance. It was another mirror, he realized. But one who tracked Aelin everywhere like some dog. Or wolf, he supposed. Adian hadn't pitted himself against the male in the sparring ring,
but he'd carefully watched Fenris take on Rowan and Gavriel, both of whom had trained the male. Fenris fought as he'd expected a warrior with centuries of training by two lethal killers to fight. But he had not glimpsed another whisper of the magic that allowed Fenris to leap between places, as if walking through some invisible doorway. As if his thoughts summoned the immortal warrior, Fenris swaggered out from the shadows below deck